Okay, I'm going to call to order the July 15th meeting of the California Water Commission. Welcome Paula as our new executive director, if you could call the roll.
Commissioner Ball.
Present.
Commissioner Byrne.
Here.
Commissioner Curtin. Commissioner Daniels. Commissioner Del Bosque.
Here.
Commissioner Herrera.
Here.
Commissioner Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Quintero.
Here.
We have a quorum. I would like to point out at this time some of the protocol for public comments. Speaker cards are available at the table in the back of the room. Brianna, over here, will collect the speaker cards. Speakers will be called up one at a time. The chair will call the name of the current speaker and the name of the next speaker, so you can anticipate when it will be your turn at the mic. Staff will make every effort to call speakers in the order that the cards were received, but we can't guarantee that we'll go through that exact order. Thank you.
Okay, and also on the speaker items, I'm going to try to limit comment to about 3 minutes if we have a lot of people, obviously with some liberties there, so if people, we'll give them some opportunity to speak for sure, but if there are a lot of people, I'm going to try to stick to that time limit so we can move the meeting along. Okay, so I'm going to move to item number 3 on the agenda, which is approval of the last meeting minutes. Entertain a motion if there's no changes.
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Quintero.
I'll second, but I have a...
Seconded by Commissioner Orth with an edit.
Under item 11 on page 5, paragraph 4, at the very bottom, there's a statement that's attributed to me regarding the return on investment calculation. And I probably didn't make myself as clear as was intended that, and I would hope that we could clarify that the context of that discussion was kind of contrasting the traditional return on investment calculation for a project against the return on investment as it's defined in Chapter 8, which is really focused on the value of the public benefit component. So I think it would be helpful to just clarify that, you know, I pointed out the distinction between the traditional return on investment versus the return on investment based on public benefit.
Okay, so why don't we, Maureen or Paula, maybe we can make appropriate edit to that after the meeting. We can approve the minutes with that edit, and then Commissioner Orth can work with you on the appropriate language for that. We've got a first and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Yes, Mr. Curtin, welcome. Here, present. two for one there, present and aye in the minutes. Okay, great. So the minutes are approved. We'll move on to the next item of business, which is number 4, Executive Officer's Report. Ms. Landis.
Thank you. Most of the activities that the Commission staff have been involved in this past month will be covered in following presentations. I will mention one just to emphasize it. That is the 3 remaining public meetings that we have coming up to inform the public and get public input, and those are July 27th in Napa, July 30th in West Sacramento, and August 10th in Bakersfield. And Jenny will be going over that when she makes the presentation on communication and engagement. The second item I have is staff-related in that the Office of the Chief Counsel for the Department of Water Resources did advertise the attorney for position for the commission. That advertisement closed last week, and we anticipate that the Office of the Chief Counsel will be scheduling interviews in the near future.
Any questions? Comments? Okay, great. Thank you. Number 5 on the agenda is commission member reports. Any commissioners at this time opportunity to report anything they've done? Commissioner North.
Let me report that on July 9th, I was invited to a meeting by Tulare County Supervisor Alan Ishida. At this meeting, there were representatives from Fresno County, Tulare County, Kings County, and Kern County, as well as some Valley Water Districts. The role that I played in that meeting was to provide those entities with some clarity on how the Chapter 8 process and eligibility for funding for storage projects applies. I think we've all seen, subsequent to that meeting, some press that the counties in the southern San Joaquin Valley are trying to create a joint powers agency to begin developing some storage strategies, and I just assisted them in understanding how Chapter 8 can move that along.
Anybody else? Commissioner Dabowski.
On, I think it was June 19th, Commissioner Orth and I were invited to present the Water Storage Investment Program to the San Joaquin Valley Partnership Drinking Water Forum and Tour in Hanford, where we presented the PowerPoint presentation of our Water Storage Investment Program.
I have a few things. I visited with the Irvine Ranch Water District on July 7th, and also with the Semi-Tropic Water District on July 9th about the Water Storage Investment Program, and I also gave a briefing to the East Branch State Water Project contractors on where we are on June 29th. Okay, so seeing no other reports, we'll move to item number 6, which is public testimony. This is an opportunity for anyone in the public to speak to matters that are not on the agenda. We also have public testimony as each agenda item is called. As was indicated earlier, there are speaker cards that are available, which can be submitted to Brianna, which is right there at the desk in front. So if there are any public comments on any items that are not on the agenda, now would be the time. Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to the next item, which is Mr. Casey Shemke, the legislative update. Welcome, Casey.
Good morning. So the document that is in your binder is it's about 4 pages, just a bill list that I'll run through. Apparently we don't have it linked up, but it is attached to the agenda. I know it's there for folks online to look at. Before we get to that, though, I was just going to give a little legislative calendar update. This coming Friday is the policy committee deadline for policy committees in the legislature. It is also the beginning of the summer recess of the legislature. They will be gone and returning on August 17th, at which point I believe they have about 2 full weeks. And on the 28th is the fiscal committee deadline. So August 28th is the fiscal committee deadline. And then for this first year of a 2-year session, the legislative session ends on September the 11th this year. So that kind of gives you some time frame as to what they're looking at. This week is a pretty heavy policy committee week. I can give you a little information. So the list that you have before you identifies some bills that were up for hearing in committee yesterday. There are others up for hearing today. So this is a full week going on from a policy committee perspective. Bills that pass that have a fiscal impact then move to the appropriations committees of each house, or the relevant appropriation committee, wherever the house the bill is in, and then move from there. And like I said, bills must be passed out of those fiscal committees by the 28th of August, but that's only 10 days after they return from recess in August. So that gives you some kind of a little timeline as to where we stand. As per usual, I don't change things up on you a whole lot. Just generally provide you with a list somewhat broken out by subject matter of bills that we as a department are looking at or that relate to our departmental activities or water in general. It is definitely not entirely inclusive. And some of that is, I can give you a little information on it as we move through this and just kind of cover generally some of these, talk about a couple of them specifically, and then I can respond to any questions if you have any questions about any of the proposals. Just to give you some basic information, in the first section here on drought and water conservation, AB1 by Assemblymember Brown dealt with local governments fining residences for not watering lawns. That was actually, this shows that it was enrolled. It was actually signed by the governor, I believe, Monday. So that one has changed. The next two are just references to the spring drought bills that passed that became law in March, providing some additional drought funding and some of the statutory changes associated with drought response. There are a number on the next bottom of that page and on the top of the next page of groundwater-related bills. Some relate to the argument being fixes to last year's legislation. Some are maybe a little bit more than fixes. Some are looking at different changes. Those are all still in the policy committee process. Actually, several were just heard yesterday and amendments were taken. So we're going to have to kind of see what pans out with regard to some of those. I think there's still a number of issues outstanding where there are significant differences between, say, a bill that originated in the Senate and a similar bill that originated in the Assembly. Both tend to still be moving forward. So those discussions are still continuing. Obviously, a decision will have to be reached at some point, or perhaps all options will be tossed onto the governor's desk for a final determination. I know we will have to see how that plays out. Walking through just a little bit more, and just for clarification, on the second page, third bill down, SB 13, Senator Pavley has introduced a bill early that was intended to be the technical fixes to last year's SGMA program. On the previous page, AB 617 by Assemblymember Perea deals with some of those issues. And I just thinking to myself, I probably shouldn't even have started down this path, because now I feel like I should walk you through all of them. So suffice it to say, there are still some issues being dealt with on a number of these bills. In addition to that, we've got some water management related legislation, some dealing with urban water management plans, some dealing with integrated regional water management plans. I am on page 2 of my little handout. We're looking at the bottom item. Our Senator Lara has a bill relating to trying to assist small nonprofits in not having to cover costs on project work when they are a project proponent under the Integrated Regional Water Management Planning program. Sometimes it's talking about advanced payment or providing some early funds so that a small nonprofit that doesn't have much of a budget isn't stuck holding, you know, $30,000-$40,000 worth of debt while they're waiting for the billing process to occur. So that gives you some idea as to what we're talking about here. Page 3 of the bill, top of the page, Senator Wolk has a bill dealing with water loss audits, requiring those to be, they're already part of the urban water management planning process. This would require the loss audits to be reported. The bill was just amended, I think, on the 6th or 7th, and it was just amended again yesterday. So I don't want to give a whole lot of details to what might be in those amendments until we see them. But primarily it deals with, they were dealing with issues of funding, seeking out some funding at the water board to provide some of the technical assistance and some of the contracting on the water audits. That's just something of interest to keep an eye on when we see the amendments on that. And then we have a pretty extensive miscellaneous section. I have to come up with a better term than that, because they are they're each unique in and of themselves to some extent. Again, the Wild and Scenic Rivers bill on the McCollumy River would require a Resources Secretary to conduct a study to determine are there sections of the McCollumy River suitable for a determination as a wild and scenic river. Moving to page 4 on the list, Assemblymember Garcia has a bill relating to the Salton Sea. It would require an investigation and a list to be prepared by the Secretary of shovel-ready projects, and then it determines what shovel-ready means for the purposes of the bill. One that we are particularly interested in looking at, SB 471 by Senator Pavley, relating to water and energy. Currently, early on, the bill dealt with ensuring that water treatment was an eligible use of greenhouse gas reduction fund dollars from the cap and trade program. Recently, it was amended and requires the Energy Commission to update a past study they've done on water and energy, the nexus between water and energy use. And it also would create, direct the State Water Resources Control Board to create a grant and loan program specific to water and energy use. So we've been watching that one as it has progressed through, and those amendments are just over a week old at this point. So we've been in conversation with the author's office as to what exactly they are envisioning with that. One at the bottom, second from the bottom, that we had talked about previously on one of my visits, I just put it on here just so that it didn't hang out there without resolution. SB 554 was the bill that would have provided for removal of one of you should you take an action in which you have a financial interest in the decision. We talked about that, I think, very briefly early on when it was introduced. That bill did not pass out of the House of Origin. It didn't move forward in this year of the legislative session. So I thought I would just give you that courtesy of circling back and letting you know the status of that. So I do believe the conversation at the time was there are other, and I'll defer to your legal representation at this point, there are other provisions of law and consequences of such determination
adequately
other than the removal from office. So that is a very brief universe of bills that we are watching. I don't want to run through all of them because I know you have a full calendar of presentations and actions today, but that's my little run through. If there's something that jumped out that one of you might have a question on, I'd be happy to do my best to speak to that.
Okay, thank you, Casey. Any questions from any commissioners? A lot of activity, but you're right. We do have a lot of stuff to do. So I appreciate the update, and we'll see you at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Thanks, Casey. Okay. And I assume there's no public comments on that item. Okay, moving to item 8 on the agenda, which is consideration of the Model Water Efficient Landscape Ordinance. Peter Brostrom from the DBR Water Use Efficiency Section. Welcome, Peter. Thank you for coming.
Good morning. I'm Peter Brostrom. I lead the Water Use Efficiency Section at DWR, and we're here today to talk about the Model Efficient Landscape Ordinance. Governor Brown, at his April press conference at the snow survey, where there wasn't really any snow, laid out 33 directives for the state to implement. Number 11 was a directive to DWR to revise the landscape ordinance and directed us to look at 4 specific measures: more efficient irrigation systems, gray water usage, on-site stormwater capture, and limiting the portion of landscapes that can be covered in turf. He also directed us to develop reporting requirements for local agencies on the implementation and enforcement of the ordinance by December 31st of this year. So a little bit of background on the ordinance. These changes often occur with drought, The first ordinance was passed in 1992. It was updated after the last drought of 2007-2009, and it applies primarily to new development. And then also to retrofits of landscapes where a building permit is required. It uses a water allowance approach, which I'll go into in more detail in a little bit. Over 500 land use agencies in the state are subject to this. Those are cities and counties. And then local agencies can adopt their own ordinance, but their ordinance has to be at least as effective as the state's ordinance. So a little bit of background on sort of the key part of this, the water allowance approach. There's really three factors that are used to calculate the water allowance. First is landscape area. The more area, the larger the size of the landscape, the larger the budget. The second is reference evapotranspiration, and I'll go in, try to explain this briefly. So we all know that if you go out to the desert, you're going to require a lot more water than if you're in the cool coastal areas. So scientists have quantified this by looking at the water requirement for a rapidly growing cool season grass, and have developed ways to actually quantify it down to the inches, on a daily basis or on a yearly basis. If you look in the ordinance on page 26, Appendix A, list values across the state, and it just so happens that Humboldt County and Imperial County are right next to each other. Well, in Humboldt, the city of Eureka requires 27.5 inches of water a year to keep grass growing rapidly, while down in Imperial County and Holtville, it takes almost 85 inches of water a year to keep grass growing rapidly. So this reference evaporation allows the ordinance to be used in all areas of the state. If you look through this, we've got historical data for, every county and large communities within that county. So the third factor is an evapotranspiration adjustment factor. And this is based on the ratio of plant water use to irrigation efficiency. University of California has worked on developing sort of plant water factors for over 3,500 landscape plants. That's put together in a document called WUCLs. And in that, those plants are categorized if they're high use, medium use, low water use, or very low. And so the ordinance sets a goal of having an average plant factor of medium water use. And so the initial ordinance looked at having one-third of the area be in high water use, one-third medium, and one-third low, so that the average plant water use was 0.5. That sort of a hypothetical number, as I'll explain in a minute. You can adjust that based on your budget and your types of plants you want to put in. And then there's an irrigation factor that's put in because irrigation systems are not perfect. You can't provide, it's difficult to provide a uniform volume of water across the entire site, so that plant factor is increased to account for the deficiencies in irrigation. So the original ordinance passed in 92 had a water allowance of 80% of evapotranspiration. So if you were in a community that had a reference evaporation, evapotranspiration of 50 inches a year, your water allowance would be 40. In 2009, that the ordinance was revised and that water allowance was moved down to account for improvements in irrigation efficiency, and that budget was lowered to 70% of reference evapotranspiration. And so if it was, if the reference was 50, now your water allowance was 35 inches a year. Areas of, let's, recreational areas, areas irrigated with recycled water are exempt from the budget and are allowed to sort of a water allowance of the reference of evapotranspiration. So if a school, a new school is going in, the ball fields would be considered a special landscape area, and those, that that area would, could be irrigated at the level of the reference of evapotranspiration. To provide an example of how the water allowance permits flexibility, so the 2009 ordinance could be met through a combination of one-third high, one-third medium, or one-third low, or a designer could choose to put in half the landscape as high water use plants and half the landscape as low, or they could choose to put in all medium water use plants or any other combination in there as long as it met the water allowance. So since the executive order was passed on April 1st, we started this process of revising the ordinance. In April and May, we held a number of stakeholder meetings. June 12th, we released a public draft, held public meetings to take comment on the draft on June 16th and 19th. We received written comment by June 26th. On June 9th, we received the draft that we are presenting to you today. And then, you know, we have today's meeting. We did, since the release of the draft on July 9th, you know, we were on a time frame. We went back. We found some clerical errors, some things that could clarify the document a little bit, and we presented that to you as an errata sheet today. So going through the ordinance, we've highlighted six main areas where we've revised it. The first is we've lowered this maximum applied water allowance. We've included provisions for increased water use efficiency. We've provided incentives for gray water use. We've lowered the size of the landscape that the ordinance applies to, and included measures to increase on-site stormwater capture, and then specified the new reporting requirements for local agencies. And I'll go through each one of these. And all of these have been revised since the public draft based on public comment, and we've detailed those revisions in the memo that we provided to you with the ordinance. So first of all, on the maximum applied water allowance, we've proposed lowering the water budget from 70% of reference evaporation for residential accounts to 55%. This would lower the area of high water use plants of turf that could be installed in a new residential landscape from roughly 33% down to 25%, with the remaining 75% either being medium or low water use plants. For commercial, industrial, and institutional, we proposed lowering the water budget to 45% of reference evapotranspiration. This will effectively limit the use of high water use plants in commercial landscapes unless they are required for a specific function like recreational areas, picnic areas, or if recycled water is being used. Additionally,
Peter, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted, for commissioner's benefit, the errata sheet is this gold one that's in the packet. So these are the changes from the July 9 version and all of them. Okay, got it. Thanks. Sorry, Peter.
So in addition, we've decreased the revised the levels of irrigation efficiency that are used in the calculation of the water allowance and changed sort of how it's done. In the past, there was one default measure that was 71% that was used for all landscape sites across the state. We've set the default measures based on drip irrigation at 81% and for overhead sprays at 75%, and then have revised our worksheet so that when someone is calculating the water use for their site, they will incorporate those values based on the different zones in their landscape. So if someone's designing a landscape that is using all drip, their irrigation efficiency would be calculated higher than an area that was using all overhead spray irrigation. And so it allows the designer to better fine-tune their water allowance to the specific landscape. These water budgets, won't be all gravel and cactus. This is a picture of a roadside berm in Santa Rosa that last year was irrigated at 26% of the reference evapotranspiration for that area. Here's a picture of a home in Martinez that has a low water use landscape installed in it. And another new home with low water use landscapes. We think these can be attractive and match kind of the direction that the California public is looking at in terms of landscapes. The second major revision in the ordinance was we increased irrigation efficiency standards, required all irrigation emitters to meet a new national standard, and for sprinklers, as part of that standard, we required that they meet a distribution uniformity of 0.65%. We've also required master shutoff valves, flow sensors for large landscapes, and water meters for large residential landscapes and non-residential landscapes over 1,000 square feet. To provide gray water incentives, we've specified that for landscapes that meet all their irrigation requirements through gray water or on-site rainwater capture, we've simplified the compliance requirements for those landscapes, and we hope this would be an incentive for builders to look at this new technology that's coming out and include it as they plan their developments. We've seen across the state where small landscapes can result in large amounts of water loss, and we've reduced the landscape size threshold from the previous ordinance from 2,500 square feet down to 500 square feet for new development projects. We had this in our public draft. There was considerable concern, number of comments that this was very costly for small landscape projects. So in this draft, we've included a checklist compliance approach for those landscapes that are between 500 square feet and 2,500 square feet, which simplifies the approach to meeting the landscape requirements, and which should be much less costly and onerous. Less onerous. For stormwater capture, we've required tillage and compost to increase water infiltration on site, and then recommended implementation of a list of stormwater best management practices. For new reporting requirements, local agencies are required to adopt their own amend or revise their own ordinance by December 1st, or after that date, the state's ordinance becomes the default. For agencies that have participated in developing a regional landscape ordinance, in the public comment, they asked for more time to develop consensus around that process. And so we've pushed that date back to February 1st of 2016. All local agencies are required to report to DWR by the end of the year. That includes agencies that are doing a regional ordinance, but they will just report on their local ordinance implementation up to that date. Agencies that are adopting a regional ordinance are required to report to DWR by March 1st of 2016 on their adoption. There are a number of issues, given the short time frame we had, that we were not able to address. We are proposing to form a stakeholder committee to consider ongoing revisions that could be done in 2 or 3 years that need more time to really discuss and vet with stakeholders. We'll look at additional ways to simplify the ordinance and improve how it's implemented at the local level. Some of the steps following, if the commission chooses to adopt the ordinance, we will be going to the Office of Administrative Law and with a file and print submission. The executive order exempted regulations under the executive order from going through the Administrative Procedures Act. In the fall, we plan to hold workshops and training to help local agencies with the adoption of their ordinance and to explain the new requirements. Again, we'll have local agency reporting between December and March. After we've received the reports from local agencies, we will report to the State Water Board on ordinance implementation. And again, we'll form a stakeholder committee in 2016. So that, in brief, is the ordinance. I welcome any questions and explain it further. Thank you.
Great. Commissioners, I'll open up to questions, then we'll have public comment. Mr. Quintero.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter, for your presentation. In the discussions that you've had, have you talked about the sort of shock absorbers that could be built into these sort of ordinances? And by that I mean, with this drought in the community where I live, suddenly a bunch of lawns went brown. And basically what that did is it stopped usage, right, for all of those square feet of lawn. But imagine the next drought where all of those yards are now highly efficient in terms of their irrigation, and we ask people to reduce their water usage, there isn't a shock absorber, really. You understand what I mean in terms of looking at some things that could be used in sort of normal years that would be okay, and can that be built into allowing some relief in terms of a future drought?
There's been talk about that, but I've also seen discussion that where native plants are being used or Mediterranean plants, they can actually tolerate a larger reduction in water use than your typical grasses or lawns. So if it was a drought and those plants were being irrigated at 30% of reference evapotranspiration, they can often go for few weeks without water and very limited water supply over to the summer to survive, where, you know, lawns, you know, will, you know, go dormant much sooner.
Yeah. And I'm not advocating for lawns. I just wanted to know what your answer is, and that's a good one. Thank
you. I've actually, you know, heard people think that these plantings, though, that they use less water actually decrease the demand hardening because they have more flexibility.
Commissioner Ball.
So I think you did a good job with this, and in some cases it probably doesn't go far enough, in my opinion. We missed a chance to talk yesterday. It's probably my fault. I think you put in the last call. But my area of concern is relative to the fact that each city has a different regulation regarding recycled water use or gray water use, and the extent to which we can start to standardize that and get over some of the issues relative to gray water. For example, in the construction industry, they use potable water to spray onto the dust at sites to work through dust palliation, and it seems a horrible waste of potable water. Those types of things, I think, are tied into health issues that some are real, some are absolutely not real, and I think that there's a tremendous amount of water potential for gray water that's being restricted, and I'd certainly like to see those taken on at a state level and some help provided to the city so that they don't have this restriction to the extent that they do on gray water. Comment on that.
Well, you know, some of that I think is in the plumbing code. We've tried to incentivize it here as much as we can. Our concern a little bit on gray water is that it's a supplemental water use. It rarely is enough to be used for the entire irrigation of the site. And that's where we've tried to incentivize it to where if someone can design a landscape so that the water demand can be met entirely by gray water, you know, we've simplified the compliance requirements significantly. Recycled water, I think, has always had significant incentives in here in that it's allowed, the water budget is reference evapotranspiration. So if you're using recycled water, you're allowed a significant more water, probably, you know, it'll be double now than what's required at the commercial level for that use. But I agree, you know, outside of the landscape ordinance, we need to work with local communities on their plumbing code to simplify the compliance requirements for installing gray water. We've had a number of talks with companies that are trying to bring gray water into the state and have heard their frustration with the different requirements across the state. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of new technology to allow particularly new homes to put in systems that allow you to take water recycling off of showers and sinks, washing machines, and use that same water for 100% of landscaping use, as well as flushing toilets. And these systems are being restricted right now, and they make a lot of sense. So in looking at new technology, new home construction, I think that should be taken into consideration.
Commissioner DeBosque.
Well, there's no doubt that the drought is causing a little bit of pain and more expense for everybody, but I think it's a pretty reasonable approach that you have here. My question was, are you basing your lawn, your ETO, on a specific type of grass? Because I understand there may be different kinds of grasses that you may look at in the future that may use less water than others.
Yeah, so the reference of evapotranspiration is defined, you know, all sorts of science literature on this as a cool season grass that's rapidly growing. And there's no doubt, you know, that the turf industry is coming up with significantly, you know, lower water use turfs. And those where, you know, they can fit under the water budget would be perfectly acceptable. Bermuda grass uses 60% of reference evapotranspiration. So that those warm season grasses are already lower water use than your typical Kentucky bluegrasses, summer cool season grasses that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Daniels. You got to lean into it. Press hard.
I think you just have to have the right touch. Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Peter, for your presentation. I'm sorry I walked in a little late, but we had a chance to talk on Friday, and I've read all of this pretty carefully. I have a few questions. One of them is you mentioned that you're going to report back on the compliance with the ordinance to various entities. I'd like to ask that you report back to our commission as well in January if you're getting some information by December. I think it would be good for us to see how this is going.
We're so not quite sure of the date of our report to the board, but when it's acceptable, when we report to the board, we will report to the commission as well.
Okay.
The State Water Resources Control Board.
Thank you. And then along those lines, I know you're going to be convening a stakeholder group that will start meeting in February or sometime early next year
right. To
look at some remaining issues. I know you had a very short period of time to put this together. It's a lot of work, and it does show quite a bit of progress toward trying to manage our landscapes in this current climate that we're facing. But a lot of questions have been raised. So I'm wondering what the process might be with the stakeholder group for the potential for revision. It's complicated because once municipalities get this and start trying to implement it to start making changes later, it gets confusing for municipalities. So there should be an opportunity, though, as you work through these things to make revisions. So how do you see that playing out?
Well, similar to sort of how the Building Standards Commission works, they often revise their regulations on a three-year basis.
Uh-huh.
And I think we might look 3 years down the road to see our and take the time to see if there are ways that we can simplify it, issues that were not able to be addressed here, that we can have a longer conversation with stakeholders and interested parties on. And then, we could potentially come back in 2 or 3 years to you with a revised amendment based on those discussions.
So I know that's a short time frame in ordinance life, but in terms of trying to manage a drought, might there be a potential to make some changes in conjunction with some other programs? So the area I'm thinking of in particular is that of stormwater capture. So obviously it's going to be really difficult to structure something that's going to apply statewide in a landscape ordinance. But a lot of work is happening at the State Water Resources Control Board and the Regional Water Quality Control Board level on stormwater capture. Is there a way to peg or link in some aspects of managing landscapes with that work so that that can happen, as...
So I think as part of the stakeholder committee, but I think also kind of as a broader discussion among state agencies and with, local, regional boards of how should stormwater be handled on site. Mm-hmm. There are these sort of recommended best management practices out there. Are there places where they should be required? Where should it be done on site, and where should it be done as more of a project basis? And where should the requirements be? Should they be in the landscape ordinance? Should they be part of existing stormwater? I think would be, a good conversation to have with the board and, with other interested parties as we try to, craft that language going forward and look at where it's been adopted by, local agencies to see what's worked and what could be improved on.
And what might be able to be used statewide.
Exactly.
So there may be other opportunities to increase our focus on that area.
Very much so.
Within the next year or so, perhaps?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then finally, Appendix D is a bit new to me, and I'm just wondering, I know you talked about it, but I'm wondering if you could walk through that. So it's clear that it applies only to landscape areas of 2,500 square feet or less. So can you kind of highlight what the big differences are?
So
between what a smaller 2,500 square feet.
Currently with the ordinance, someone submitting a packet on this would have to include soils report, a grading report, if they'd done any grading. They would have to go back and audit afterwards. And it seemed like these were very expensive requirements and documentation for, you know, a landscape that could be as small as 500 square feet. So what we tried to do, and with help from some public input, was to boil the essentials of the ordinance, what should be met for a small landscape, down into some more prescriptive approaches. It doesn't give you the options or the flexibility that the larger ordinance does. You know, high water use turf for residential is limited to 25%. You can't sort of adjust or move your plants around as much. There's very sort of specific requirements for irrigation controllers, but in a simpler way where someone submitting this package would say, yes, we have an automatic irrigation controllers and we've installed pressure regulators that could be checked off.
Prescriptive means there's a list, you follow the list, and you're basically okay, right?
Yeah.
Just
yeah. If you need, the things that are listed there, you're good.
Okay. Do you have any sense of how many landscapes are in that category of under 25, what percent are in that category of under 2,500 square feet?
Well, again, I think it's a smaller number because the production's the landscape area is calculated on a project basis. And so if the aggregate area of the project is over 2,500 square feet, then they have to meet all the ordinance requirements.
Right.
So often the production homes that are going in are well over, that threshold. So it would be, sort of specific smaller projects where, one lot's being developed or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we don't have specific numbers.
Of how many, but yeah. Okay, thank you. I'll look forward to public comment.
Okay. Mr. Curtin.
I apologize. I had to step out. I'm not sure if this was discussed at all. I'm concerned about trees involved in landscaping and how they would be dealt with differently or in conjunction with grass, because we're losing millions of trees around the state, mostly in the forest, but there are some concerns, at least in my neighborhood, about, okay, how do we deal with the existing trees, which are pretty mature, if we have limited ability to water?
So, again, the landscape primarily applies to new or, rehabilitated. It doesn't apply to mm-hmm. existing. For new landscapes, we recommended, that there be a separate irrigation system set up for trees so that they could be irrigated separately from, the landscape that's underneath it. Often trees, are in a very different cycle where they, especially, ornamental trees need to be watered deeply every 3 weeks or so opposed to, there's less water use or more frequent water use required of other plants in the landscape. I think, this ordinance, very much supports inclusion of trees and establish an irrigation system that supports their growth and development.
So there's no mention of it, but I'm just concerned that it's the first thing that popped into my mind. So will there be some this is a real education period here, learning curve for a lot of people, and how they handle their trees is still baffling, even for existing. I mean, I'm looking at this ordinance, and I see it's for new or remodels, more or less, but there will be people who are interested in abiding by it, even with an existing lawns. And it's just not a lot of information out there about how to protect your trees while you're reducing your water usage. Is there any plan that the commission could put together a, or not the commission, but the DWR could put together some information easily accessible to consumers about how they can protect and save their trees while they cut back on their lawn care, so to speak?
We do have that available. In fact, if you've heard the radio clips that Save Our Water is running, it says, I believe the message is like, save, lose your lawn, save your trees. And our office has held workshops and press conferences on protecting trees. We've got publications available, and we can make those available to the community.
Okay, I think we need to do a little outreach as much as possible through the water agencies, which really have the ability to do it. I also had some questions. You know, gray water incentives are good, and that's for new developments, but what about existing? Is there any assistance on developing guidelines for how to retrofit for gray water usage on your property?
Well, on an existing home, I mean, the beauty of trying to do gray water with new homes is that you can do the plumbing right from the start.
Right.
And then it's more expensive to go back and, you know, try to retrofit, especially when the home has been built on slab and trying to deal with plumbing that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are some of the constraints there where we see some of the initial effort. If we can try to get new homes going in and to show how effective that is, then maybe that will carry over to existing homes, especially where, you know, they're built on raised foundations where there's a little more possibility of accessing the plumbing and making the changes that way. But it's still relatively an expensive proposition to go back and retrofit.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I've got a couple quick questions, Peter, in the interest of time and knowing that we have public comment as well. So the threshold, what is, just in practical terms, what are the common ways in which the threshold would be triggered as far as a permit or whatnot for a retrofit? I get the new, so if I'm at home and I want to, you know, put in some new grass, do I typically need a permit for that or?
No. So typically for a retrofit, it only comes if there's a building requirement, and that threshold is larger. That's 2,500 square feet where the landscape's being modified. So it's we've left that the same. We have not changed those requirements.
So. Okay. So then your average Joe, as people call me, are usually not going to have to really do this unless they're doing something that's more substantial.
Right. Unless it involves, you know, pulling a permit and it's modifying over, you know, 2,500 square feet of landscape, which is a significant area. That's the only time the retrofit comes into play.
Okay, got it. And I get the Appendix D, and I think that's helpful. And similar to Commissioner Daniels, I'm also interested in going forward because it does seem like there's a lot of things that could be done, especially on the stormwater capture. But I'm sure we'll hear from people as well. So any other comments or before we go to public comment? Okay, Peter, if you could stand by.
Yeah,
I'm anticipating needing you to respond or having you respond to folks. If you haven't submitted a speaker card, please do. I've got five people here. We're trying to stick to about 3 minutes, not including maybe Q&A, just a presentation. And I'll start with Ron Walfarth of Rainbird. Thank you, Ron. Welcome.
Thank you, members of the commission. I'm Ron Walfarth, speaking on behalf of Rainbird Corporation. We're a worldwide manufacturer of irrigation products based here in California. The June 9th draft of the changes to this ordinance presented many concerns for Rainbird and the irrigation industry. There were many good improvements in that draft. But as I mentioned, Rainbird had some concerns, and some of them were very, very serious. We made public comments verbally and in writing, and the DWR staff, Peter Brostrom, Julie Sarr Edmonds, and Vicki Lake and others, I'm sure, did a fabulous job in responding to not only our comments, but those of which we were familiar with. They listened carefully. I understand they had 170 comments, all of which they addressed in a very short period of time, including the July 4th weekend. And somehow I think my July 4th weekend was better than theirs. The result is the draft that they issued on July 9th. All of Rainbird's serious concerns were addressed. Most of our other concerns were well addressed. And other areas where we remain unsatisfied, we can live with. Therefore, Rainbird supports the July 9th draft as it is written and encourage you to adopt it. Again, I want to acknowledge and thank the DWR staff for their willingness to listen, their hard work at understanding the issues, and finding that good balance point in responding to very diverse public input and comment. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Ron. Okay, next I'm going to go to Bob Raymer, CBIA.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm Bob Raymer, Senior Engineer with the California Building Industry Association. And while CBIA doesn't have a formal position of support, I can tell you that over the past 4 to 5 weeks, we've had a very productive working relationship with DWR staff, and I am certainly going to be recommending a strong support position to our Governmental Affairs Committee that will be getting together in about 3 weeks. So with that, I'd like to tell you that we had submitted our comments after the initial June 12th document. This is a 15-page set of comments. The good news here is we tried to limit the amount of repetitive work that DWR would have to do going over a host of comments. So we submitted a coalition of 10 industry groups from the commercial and residential sector. We also coordinated our comments as best as possible with the Building Standards Commission and the Department of Housing, along with the League of Cities and CalBO, the California Building Officials. And with that, the good news here is that the vast majority of our comments have been productively responded to by DWR staff in record time. I've got to say that I've been doing regulations for CBI for over 30 years, and the recent activities of the Building Standards Commission, Department of Housing, and now DWR staff in responding to the governor's executive order is incredible. It's just an overwhelming amount of work in a short period of time, and they've done a fantastic job. Having said all that, I would like to respond to a few issues that have been raised. Number one, we're exceptionally happy that DWR has taken a more aggressive approach on incentivizing the use of gray water and rainwater capture. In new construction, residential construction, we're beginning to see widespread use of gray water and recycled water technologies along with rainwater capture. And this certainly provides, while it's not giving a check necessarily from one individual to another, it certainly provides a regulatory incentive to kind of gear up that use of recycled and gray water. And so with that, we thank DWR staff. In addition, there's been discussion about the prescriptive approach. This is something that we felt very strongly about. You know, as we do production housing, you know, each lot may well fall under this, and to have repetitive soil reports, budget numbers, et cetera, is not only repetitive, it's costly. And so what the building officials, California building officials, did is they worked with DWR staff, and they came up with a list of about 12 things, you know, a very clean cut, a list of things. You know, you can't go above 25% grass, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You do these things, you're good to go. And why that's very important is that there's also a local government aspect to all of this. It's not just, you know, industry go ahead and do a good job of trying to do this. There's also now an inspection requirement. And that's because the governor also directed what DWR was doing all of this. The governor directed the Department of Housing for residential and the Building Standards Commission for commercial to go about adopting emergency building standards. As of June 1st, The California Green Building Standards had incorporated emergency amendments that effectively require a more aggressive application of the existing WELLO budget. That's now part of the building codes and standards that all new homes and commercial buildings have to comply with. And the good news here is there's a follow-up rulemaking that both HCD and BSE will have to do as the result of an emergency. Within 180 days, they have to come back around and finish their rulemaking, even though there's building standards in right now. The administrative law takes into account that maybe there needs to be some tweaks made. Well, the benefit of this secondary permanent rulemaking is that the updates that DWR has made to the MWELO here both Building Standards Commission and HCD will have the opportunity to look at what DWR has done, and believe me, they've been watching very closely, and they'll now incorporate, to the extent that there's building standards in here, they'll incorporate that into the California Green Building Code. The benefit of that, all 500-plus jurisdictions in the state of California through the local building departments will be checking for these items during plan check and final inspection. And so for the first time, we've got an army of local code enforcement who will be out there looking for compliance on this, and that's a good thing. And once again, that gets back to the prescriptive approach. It's a whole lot easier and less costly for local government to look at a prescriptive list as opposed to going through the budget calculations and all that. So once again, we're very thankful to DWR. And sort of bringing this to a close, Commissioner Curtin raised the issue of the urban forest issue. That's still sort of an outstanding issue. While certainly DWR staff has addressed a number of things in here, we've seen some initial calculations from some very bright landscape architects, and it looks like urban forests aren't faring very well. And of course, these regs only apply to new construction. It doesn't mean you necessarily need to pull back on the water that's being used in the existing areas. But one of the things that's going to happen when you, particularly with a large commercial facility, you may want to take out the grass. And you may want to put in the trees. If it's a large enough area, you're going to have to pull a permit. And so once again, one of the things we'll be doing with DWR in the coming months and years is working with them on how to maybe clarify all of this with the urban forest. And we'll be doing the same thing with HCD and Building Standards Commission as they update their regs. So that brings it to a close. Once again, I'll be recommending to our Governmental Affairs Committee a strong support position. And thanks, DWR, for the time and effort put into this.
Great question. Commissioner Daniels.
Thank you. If the comment letter was sent to the commission, I haven't seen it. I don't see it in a packet. I'm just wondering if it's available to us. There's only a couple comment letters in our packet.
You have to press and hold, yeah. There you
it's go. A really push it, I learned.
I realize that it's not in there, and I'm sure we can get it to you. I think there were a couple of them that we had provided last month as well.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it's an older one.
All of the comments that were submitted, if you go to DWR's website, there's 170 of these things, and they're all put in alphabetical order, so it's pretty easy to find.
Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate it. Okay, Tracy Quinn, NRDC. Welcome, Tracy.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the huge undertaking and hard work by the DWR staff. As you guys have seen and it's been acknowledged already, the July 9th version includes several changes from the June 12th version that was available for public comment. The most significant change that we see is the brand new prescriptive approach, which is included as Appendix D. And this is available for landscapes under 2,500 square feet, excuse me. With new development trending towards smaller lots, this prescriptive approach is likely to become the primary compliance path for most of California. And while we support the inclusion of a prescriptive path, a prescriptive approach to improve the implementation and compliance with the model ordinance, I find it extremely concerning that this language was not made available to the public until just a few days ago. We did a preliminary review and identified at least 10 issues with Appendix D that need to be resolved before final adoption. I'll go through them briefly to try to comply with the 3 minutes. The Appendix D fails to include the requirement for the installation of a landscape meter for all commercial landscapes over 1,000 square feet. This is something that's easy to verify. It's silent on the treatment of water features. In the main body of the model ordinance, the surface area of water features is to be included in the high water use category, hydrozone of the water budget. And then there's no water budget in Appendix D, so it's excluded. Additionally, easy to verify requirements for water features, such as the use of recirculation systems and the availability of pool covers, are also excluded. Appendix D omits the requirement that all irrigation systems have rain or frost sensors to eliminate water during times that would be unnecessary and wasteful. It contains no prohibition against overhead irrigation within 24 inches of non-permeable surfaces. The listing of project types in the landscape documentation package in B1E should not include homeowner installed, as this the term homeowner installed, as this activity has been removed. The definitions in the main body of MWLO should be clarified or called out in Appendix D. I think we've already seen some confusion here about the definition of landscape area. There are no specifics about what a soil test must show to waive the composting requirement. The plant factor requirements appear strong. We support those. And exclusions based on only two factors, edibles and recycled water, rather than the full list of functions in the main section of the special landscape area. However, determining the area of edibles could easily become a problem. If fruit trees are planted, there is no guidance on the type or irrigation method for ground cover that will be that will be there until trees reach maturity. It says, Appendix D says that turf and parkways must use subsurface methods or other technology that creates no overspray or runoff. This allows the use of overhead irrigation based on vendors' claims of efficiency. The problem is that with parkways is not only that their narrow shape leads to overspray, it's that there's the potential for foot traffic and breakage of those irrigation systems that are above ground, so we feel that they should be required to be subsurface. And finally, it should be clarified that to require irrigation controllers to retain all programming data rather than just programming dates. So those are issues just with Appendix D. In addition, the revised model ordinance also fails to address existing landscapes in any significant way. The governor's executive order specifically asked that the revised ordinance address new and existing landscapes. One potential improvement we see to get existing landscapes would be to reduce the size threshold for rehabilitated landscapes. It's currently set at 2,500 feet, square feet. That high number was appropriate when only a performance-based approach was available. Now that DWR has presented a prescriptive approach, it makes lowering the threshold to 500 more appropriate and easier for compliance. And we also recommend including a requirement for compliance with MWLO if you have a major building renovation as well. We've seen that in cities throughout the state. There's still, as I mentioned earlier, there's still confusion about what constitutes landscape area. As Peter Brostrom mentioned, DWR's interpretation is that for track housing development, it would be the landscape of the full development. The person from the building industry said his interpretation was that it would be per lot, so they'd be able to use that prescriptive method. So clearly that needs to be clarified within the language of this document. The revised MWLO, the July 9th version, also exempts landscapes that are designed to have all irrigation needs met by gray water and rainwater. We think this is great. We definitely want to encourage gray water and rainwater, but there needs to be some additional caveats and requirements if you're going to use that exemption. You can design a landscape for that, but as Peter mentioned, oftentimes potable is needed to supplement those sources. And we can't have people putting in larger lawns and then supplementing that with potable water. So we feel that there needs to be some sort of restriction, possibly a requirement that there's no tie into a potable system for the landscape irrigation if you're going to use that exemption. While I understand that the commission is likely under a lot of pressure to adopt this model ordinance today, it's simply not ready. Appendix D needs to be reviewed by industry experts and other stakeholders before we can move forward. We are confident that this can be accomplished in a very short time frame, and this could be brought back to the Commission at the August date that's already on your schedule. Therefore, I'm urging you to defer your vote until the issues are addressed. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Tracy. Questions, Commissioner Ball?
No, I don't have a question. I'd just like to point out that we don't want to let great get in the way of good, and I think what is here is good, and I think that a lot of the suggestions you had are really good, and I think that you should push for their adoption in future revisions and continue to ask for that, because I think you had some really good ideas there. But I do think that this is something that we need to take care of right away and get a lot of good progress done and approved. But thank you for your comments.
Commissioner Daniels.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, Peter, if you might be able to respond to any of those comments. Is Peter still here? We told you not to go too far away.
You might want to sit in the corner.
Yeah, have you right up front. And one of the ones I had a question about was the confusion about to what landscape does this apply, because if there's...
No, in the ordinance where it references, I should have brought it up with me, but references any project. Mm-hmm. So if you're submitting a project where the aggregate landscape is under 2,500 square feet, you can use Appendix D. For projects that are greater than 2,500 square feet, which would be production homes, that would be required to meet the full ordinance. In the ordinance, so we've clarified how, you know, audits can be done and soil test, and where those are conducted on every seventh home, which conforms to the other building requirements for energy in terms of audits and checking there as well.
Okay, and a comment regarding applicability to existing landscapes?
In terms of the NRDC, what?
Right.
Well, it's we see in the drought that existing landscapes are being addressed first through the drought restrictions, the days per week, and requirements that local agencies meet drought water use targets. We see the most effective way long-term, and DWR is working on this with local agencies now, is to establish water budgets, allow local agencies to know what is the landscape area of their individual accounts, and then target the agencies that are over, or the customers that are over those budgets, and help them shrink their water use down. Coming back with requirements, further requirements on existing landscapes, I think would be part of this longer-term discussion on how we can strengthen and improve that. But
so you see the water budgets as sort of a performance-based way to get at it in a macro level?
We see that as the most effective long-term solution towards that.
Okay, finally, if there were opportunities to make, would there be opportunities to make revisions to Appendix D through the stakeholder process?
Sure.
Within the next, you know, several months to a year, or how would that process play out?
It, you know, the hesitation about doing it too soon is then we would have to come back. If we revised it, then local agencies may have to come back and revise their own ordinances.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the only hesitation about doing it too soon, but we do anticipate making revisions in the future.
It's just that that does seem like it's a newer section which didn't have as much stakeholder review. So I'm just wondering if it can be separately treated somehow through the stakeholder process. There are guidance documents. Guidance documents are sometimes managed differently than ordinances.
We'd have to think through that a little bit more in terms of how it was referenced or treated that way. We do realize that, you know, it's very new, and, you know, we released it last week. The other thing about it is it's being applied to landscapes that were previously not subject to the ordinance. So
which are the, I see. Okay, so yeah. 2,500 square feet or less.
And low, below, so that in a sense these are new requirements for landscapes that without this revision would not have been subject to it.
All right, well, that's an important point. So do you know what the average lot size is?
About 2,500 square feet or higher, you know, average.
The average landscape size in California is 2,500 square feet?
Yeah, 2,500 to 3,000 in there. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So, Peter, for me, so the question on Appendix D, so the analysis that you went through, I'm assuming, is that these are kind of the general standards that would allow you to get to what you're trying to get to through, the, in fact, more prescriptive. Is that what, I mean, what's the thinking? Because I do, the one point that Tracy made about not having, you know, 25 inches between hard surfaces, if that's a regular requirement, seems to me that it seems pretty reasonable to have that be another requirement. But so what's the overall thought process?
Well, you know, the thought process is we tried to pull out the key measures that would ensure that these small landscapes would have efficient irrigation systems and, you know, would meet the plant requirements that are reflected in the ordinance. The 24-inch setback that's required or other measures, you know, where you can show that there's no runoff or overspray, that could be something we could, you know, add to, you know, Appendix D fairly easily. But if there's small landscapes, that's pushing people more towards drip or subsurface drip anyways.
Right. And I should say I also appreciate the inclusion of it because, you know, when you're looking through it, what the requirements are, they obviously require you to hire someone and spend a decent amount of money, and this is the option for people who might not want to go through that, which I can't pretend to understand a lot of the stuff that's in there. I'd clearly need to. That's another question. How much would it cost if you go through the first part of it and not Appendix D? What would, I mean, I know it varies on project, but what do people end up paying? Maybe Commissioner Ball knows better than I do. I don't know.
I think it varies, but I mean, an audit alone on a large landscape can be $1,000. So
right.
Soil tests, depending on the number and the level, can be expensive as well. So I think a lot depends on the size and you know, how the detail of design in it as well, but it's not insignificant,
amount.
Cost.
And I would say, I mean, I wanted to say great job as well. I mean, I understand that it's not perfect and that there's things that are going to be improved. I would like to figure out a way that maybe some of these things could be considered sooner rather than later. But I appreciate the effort. I know it's super complicated. Anyway, I better get back to public comment. I forgot. Okay, next up is Larry Rolfs with the California Landscape Contractors Association. Larry, I hope I didn't get your name terribly wrong. Okay, good.
Good morning, members of the commission. My name is Larry Rolfs with the California Landscape Contractors Association. We're a trade association of about 2,000 state-licensed landscape contractors and related landscape professionals. We have been following the model ordinance for a long time, all the way back to the early 1990s. We had a member of ours who was a representative on the public advisory committee to the very first ordinance, and we've been at probably every stakeholder meeting on the ordinance since then. We know the ordinance well. We think it's a very important document for our industry and for California, and we've consistently supported its overall approach, its overall water budget approach. Today, though, I just want to compliment the DWR staff for the for their work on the document, especially since the public comment period on the June 12th draft. They heard from a lot of different organizations, including ours, and the comments came from a lot of different seemingly incompatible perspectives. But it's clear to me that they not only listened, but they managed to incorporate a lot of those comments, and they put them together in a coherent document where, you know, all the parts seem to work together. Also, they didn't make the document any more complicated than it was before, and it was a complicated document. So clearly a lot of work was done on this document since that public comment period, since the comment period on the June 12th draft, in a very, very short amount of time. I don't have a formal support position from CLCA simply because we haven't had time to digest it and have a meeting and a vote and all of that to go through our process. But every member I've talked to has nothing but good things to say about it. And I would recommend a support on it. CLCA would like to be a part of the stakeholders group that DWR plans to put together. We recognize the need to revisit it after the drought, and I'm sure there are some things, because it was done so quickly, there are probably some things that need to be fixed in the near future. We'd like to be part of the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Larry. Okay, next up we have Ed Pike with the California Utilities Codes and Standards Team. Mr. Pike. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today. My name is Ed Pike, and I'm a senior engineer representing the California Utility Codes and Standards Team, including LEDWP, PG&E, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas Electric, and Southern California Gas Company. And I'll just echo all the compliments for the DWR staff for responding in a very impressive fashion, very quickly, in response to getting the emergency rulemaking moving forward. And one aspect of that was including some comments regarding the irrigation audit. One key aspect of any standard, as I'm sure you all know, is implementation on the ground and make sure that the results that you intend are actually achieved in practice. So we appreciate that staff included a number of recommendations for what would be included in the landscape irrigation audit. And this is part of our formal comments. And we also would recommend clarifying in 492.12 that the elements of the irrigation audit are required. I know there's been some changes to definitional language, and so it would be consistent, I think, to actually in the standard itself say that certain elements are required for the audit itself to make sure that these important regulations are implemented in the field. I also wanted to comment on a very recent change, and it's not part of the official letter because it came afterwards, and there's language that would allow production homes to, the developer could audit essentially 15% rather than all of the new developments. And just one thing I wanted to mention, and if this can't be changed in standard, perhaps as was mentioned, this could be part of guidance. It'd be important to make sure that developers aren't cherry picking which of the sites they audit, and perhaps doing a better job on the 15% that get audited. And then also, if there's issues picked up in that 15%, that of course the other 85% may have a similar issue that may need to be addressed, and so they shouldn't be left out. So I just wanted to raise that to your attention. This has come up after the formal comments that came in. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to provide comment, and we very much appreciate your efforts to adopt a new regulation.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Peck. Bob Chase, DSA.
Thank you very much, members of the commission. My name is Bob Chase. I'm Deputy State Architect with the Division of the State Architect, or DSA. I want to actually laud your staff and all of the work. We've been coordinating very closely with Julie and your staff, and I'll explain what we've been doing over the last several months. But we at DSA oversee the design and construction of all K-12 public schools and community colleges throughout the state. So that's our purview, really. You heard the process that Bob Raymer described that the Building Standards Commission and HCD Housing Community Development has been going through. We were actually part of that as well. So we were developing emergency regulations over the last several months, applying to schools throughout the state. Tight timeline, as you heard Bob mention, going through. These regulations were, in fact, adopted May 29th, took effect a few days later when they were filed with the Secretary of State. One of the differences here is that we're, and again, you heard Bob, I think, describe the fact that these regulations now go out throughout the state for building departments, counties, and cities to enforce and have inspectors out there to check. At schools, they do not do that. We do that at DSA. We review the design, and we do the inspections. So we are actually in the process of developing a second set of emergency regulations to supplement the first ones we had passed. These will be going before the Building Standards Commission next week. For adoption as well. And these are going to help us and our clients, being the school districts and community colleges, know how to implement these restrictions. We've been very impressed. We've done outreach in a limited period of time with our clients, schools, community colleges. I think, for the most part, are in agreement with the restrictions, know why we need to do this, and are moving forward with that, in spite of the fact that they are all really always challenged with cost challenges as well, the schools and community colleges. With that in mind, I just had one comment that I'd like to bring up. Apologize for not having submitted it sooner, but we just caught it. Being busy with our second set of regs, we kind of just caught it. There was one item that was in the June 12th draft, and I have not seen an update in the July 4th, the present one addressing it. But basically, when we go through all of the calculations, the water allowance, the ETAF, there's typically about a 10 to 20% difference between residential and commercial projects. And we understand that totally. You can have more impact, I think, in commercial. But that's fairly consistent, I think, going through your entire ordinance. Until we get to the trigger for where meters and submeters are required on landscaping, we suddenly then jump to an 80% differential between residential and commercial. And we'd like to see that be consistent, at least, with all of the other calculations. With that, and again, if I've missed the correction on this, I do apologize, but our understanding is that meters are required, and meters are a cost factor, and that's why our schools are concerned, are required when residential projects exceed 5,000 square feet. However, when non-residential projects exceed 1,000 square feet, they're required. So the trigger, there's quite a gap between the residential of 5,000 and the commercial at 1,000. To be consistent with all of your other calculations, I think the commercial number would probably be hopefully 4,000, perhaps a little bit less than that, rather than dropping all the way down to 1,000. So other than that, as I say, we think the ordinance moving forward is excellent, and we're very proud to have been directed by the governor to be a part of moving this forward. But we'd like to ask that we think relatively minor correction. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob. Peter, is there a thought process on that one? Sorry.
So first, below 5,000 square feet for landscape, it can either be a dedicated utility meter or a private submeter, which we've been told can cost anywhere from $50 to $100. The reason to require that for landscapes gets back to this idea of having water budgets at the landscape level, that if you're not measuring how much you're using, you can't really know if you're performing to the budget. So for, especially for commercial and sites like that, we saw it as a, where they're often managed by off-site contractors, that it's important to have a meter for landscapes over 1,000 square feet so that they can track how their irrigation scheduling is doing compared to the budget. And it's not a, a utility meter, which, you know, can be expensive. It can be, you know, a private submeter that would be measured.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And there was a question before on
The audits, right.
Or on the previous, where the comments are. Those are actually posted on the agenda, our comments on the comments that we received on the June 12th draft are there. So.
Wait, you might want to just hang here. We got one last one. Mr. John Norwood, California Pools and Spa Association. Welcome, John.
Thank you for the opportunity. John Norwood on behalf of the California Pool and Spa Association. We appreciate this time. We did manage to get in some written comments, but just yesterday, so I don't expect anybody's had a chance to look at those. Almost everything you've heard today is about the commercial application, developer-installed projects. And we certainly think that there are very, you know, many, many positives with regard to saving water and addressing those kinds of projects throughout the state through this ordinance. You know, think it's a very good project from that standpoint. I guess our concerns have to do with lowering the threshold from 5,000 square feet to 500 square feet for new projects and 2,500 square feet for projects that are owner-installed projects. The fact of the matter is, up till now, MWELO has really only ever been applied to public projects, commercial developments, multifamily housing, tract homes where you have the common areas or where the developers installed the front yards. And this is because of the 5,000 square foot threshold and because in most cases, somebody putting in a backyard doesn't require a permit. And as somebody earlier indicated, that since MWELO wasn't part of the building codes, nobody looked. This is a game changer, changing the threshold and now applying it to the building codes in California. And unfortunately, in our opinion, as to residential construction, as to owner installed or contracted projects, you're doing it in a way that's going to be discriminatory, that's going to urge people to game the system and utilize the underground economy to avoid application. For example, I've got a 2,500 square foot backyard. I've decided that I'm going to rehab it, put in 2,000 square feet of lawn and maybe some stone decking kind of embedded in the ground. That's going to use a lot of water versus, let's say, I'm going to, and I'm not, there's not going to be any review of that project because it doesn't require a permit. Whereas I'm going to redo my backyard with a pool. I'm going to put in a pool that has 500 square feet of water area surrounded by 2,000 square feet of decking, outside kitchen, whatever the case may be. Maybe a little less than that. I'll have some plantings around it. Now that gets, MWELO now applies to that because of the permit requirement. Worse yet, you have a situation where somebody would like to have a lawn and a pool in their backyard because what are backyards about? You know, but an area for families together, recreation, those kinds of things. I'm not sure that would even be allowed under this ordinance because both the pool and the lawn are going to be high water users. And from the standpoint of, and you know, the MWELO and this ordinance completely disregards the fact that the pool is going to be surrounded by all this hard deck that doesn't evaporate, doesn't use water, or any of those kinds of situations. And it's clear that when you take a, for instance, 1,200 or 1,500 square foot pool, the entire thing, and compare it to turf of the same size, the pool is going to be two or three times more efficient than the turf area. So there's no consideration in this ordinance for hardscape and decking. There's no consideration. Let's say somebody wanted to spend $8,000 or $10,000 to put a permanent pool cover in to keep the pool covered when it's not in use, which would cut the evaporation down to almost nothing. Again, no consideration for that. Let's say you want to put some type of a hot tub, spa type of situation in there that are always covered and virtually have no evaporation. You might need a permit for that, depending on, and that might trigger MWLO. But those are the kinds of things you're going to see. And frankly, we don't think that that's appropriate. People are going to utilize the underground economy. They're going to figure out ways to game the system. Let's do the pool first. Let's do other things second. Anyhow, those are our concerns here. We think in part that application goes way beyond what MWLO was ever intended to apply to. So look forward to continue to work on this issue, but those are our concerns, and we don't have an official position just because we haven't had time either to get our group together, but we did want to express those concerns, and we do them in a little more detail in the written comments.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean.
Just a question quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Have you had a discussion with the DWR about these issues, or is this the first there?
No, we sent in extensive comments, and they called and did clarify that the that on the rehab projects is 2,500 square feet as opposed to 500. That really doesn't affect us, our opinion of it too much. I mean, obviously, if it was a standalone pool, you're not going to have a 2,500 square foot surface area, because that's the only thing that's measured under here when you look at that. Mm. Obviously, like to continue to discuss these issues with them.
Great. Thank you, John. Peter.
Yeah, as John said, we did meet with them, and I'm still not quite clear because, the requirement for existing landscapes, if someone was to go and put a pool in their backyard, is 2,500 square feet, and it would be the pool area. So that would be a really large pool, a bit larger than most people's homes, that would trigger the landscape ordinance. So I'm not sure if we're miscommunicating. If there's some miscommunication going on, the new construction requirement of 500 is for new buildings going in, and that landscape requirement. But if you're coming back, and typically with most homes, that is the front yard's put in and the homeowner installs the backyard. But if you were to come back after a home's been built, the ordinance would only be triggered if the pool size itself was over 2,500 square feet.
Okay. Any further questions, comments? Commissioner Herrera.
This is a question for Peter. First of all, thank you for the presentation. It was very, very informative and helpful. We heard from NRDC today about the comments on the Appendix D, and I'm just wondering whether DWR staff have heard comments from any other stakeholder since it was released.
No, those were this morning was the first we've heard any comments on that.
So. And it was that document was released late last week or?
On the 9th.
The 9th. Because I'm just wondering whether other stakeholders are going to have comment on that document. I agree, when you sort of lay out a document like that, that's kind of what people follow, and it'd be great if people would have had the opportunity to provide comments on that.
Right. We acknowledge it was, a short turnaround. We could, and I wasn't able to write down, the 10 items that they listed, but we could look at their list and see if there were some clear measures that, we may be left off, and we could bring that back to you, potentially even later today, or I believe you're meeting tomorrow as well. Our goal would be, I think, again, to try to make sure that it's a simpler approach to compliance, that we're not making it more complex with the requirements, but we could look at their list and see if there are items that we missed and that should have been included.
I think that's a good idea. Yeah.
How does everyone else feel about that? Can we do it later today, Maureen? I guess we can essentially put on hold.
Are you asking can we vote on it later today? Or can we consider the...
Yeah, can we vote on it later today?
If the commission...
We can obviously do it tomorrow as well, but if there's...
Right. I think the important legal thing is that any changes that are made that are being considered need to be available to the public simultaneously with their availability to the commission. So all interested parties here have an equal and timely opportunity to look at what we're proposing.
Maybe we can... I get that. Just whatever is given to us needs to be given to the public. So that's clear. So if you could get together, then if that's the consensus, I definitely wouldn't want to not move forward either today or tomorrow. But if there's a chance, I think we can, you know, postpone or what's the proper term, to essentially put it on hold and not close the item until the end of the day. And if there's things that are very easy to add, we can maybe add them. Or
why are we postponing it? I'm not an advocate of postponing. I think there's a lot of different things that have been brought up that can be considered or could be considered. I think that we should either move forward on this thing and vote for it today. I think postponing it is just going to create a slippery slope of what should be done, what could be done. Don't we need a little more time? I think we should act on the document as exists today. That would be my...
I guess the question is, and Peter raised it, is whether there are some extremely low-hanging fruit that are very easy that maybe you hadn't thought of that you'd like to think about, or, you know, because other than that, I'd be hesitant to make a significant change as well, because I would want to give other stakeholders an opportunity. So if it was something that was... you know, I think of that 25 inches. I'm not sure if that's significant enough, though, for us to be pushing it back.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look at their list, but, I mean, I think what we captured ensures, you know, as a first step, ensures that these small landscapes have efficient irrigation systems and, you know, the appropriate plannings with them. Can it be improved? I mean, I think going into the future, yes, but, I mean, we could take a look at their list and see if, you know, there are, as you say, low-hanging fruit, things that would not add to the compliance requirements that could be quickly included in that, or language clarified.
Your comments from commissioners. The more I think about it, why don't we put it on hold until right after lunch, and then we can revisit it with you and see if there are anything that you think would be worth or that would be includable but would not be something that would generate any real significant changes that would maybe require more folks to come back. I mean, I understand the perception or the position of a few of the commissioners that it was late, and obviously there's some opportunity for people to comment, and the fact that you haven't really seen the comments and known about them, then maybe we can bring it back after lunch just to give you the opportunity to comment more thoroughly on what it is that they've presented. And it may be that I'm with Commissioner Ball in wanting to move this forward and today if possible. And I think you've done a great job in many, many ways, and we're really moving the ball forward, and it's not going to be perfect. And that's why I've talked about what Commissioner Daniels has mentioned as well, is hopefully having us be involved in the process and try to expedite some potential future amendments and changes going forward. So is that okay? Maureen, we're fine doing that?
I think that works. We also have set up the agenda to facilitate the possibility of a vote on this tomorrow if necessary.
And I think we ought to just come back. My thought is it's an opportunity for you to at least spend 10 minutes without us waiting for you to look at what it is and then comment on it. And then we'll come back and close the loop one way or the other.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, any other public comment on that issue? Okay, great. All right, we're going to move on then to number 11 on the agenda, or I'm sorry, number 9 on the agenda, which is Sustainable Groundwater Management Act implementation presentation. Steve Springhorn from DWR. And quickly, I'm sorry, so for the public's benefit, that'll be right at 1:30. Okay, sorry, Mr. Springhorn.
All right. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. My name is Steven Springhorn. I am a member of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Implementation Team, and today I'll be discussing an informational update on the Basin Boundary Regulations, which is the first set of regulations for the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act.
Sorry for the noise. You're like the next hitter after someone hits a home run.
Should I pause for a second?
Yeah, it's okay.
All right, the items I'd like to cover today are an update on the draft regulation process and discuss, thank you, discuss how we go from today moving forward to the adoption of the regulations, so the steps we plan to take. Then I'd like to spend time on an overview of the draft regulations, so talking about the overall concept of the regulation, and then putting that regulation into context, and then finally wrap up with the next steps. So getting into the regulation process, you've seen this slide before. I've presented it a few times now, and really this is how we've been marching through the phases of implementation of these regulations, and a key point here is that we've received a lot of valuable feedback and input from stakeholders and the public on the issues and challenges with basin boundary as they exist now and this regulation process. So we used a lot of that stakeholder input in developing the draft framework and developing these draft regulations that will soon be available. So here's the roadmap and the steps we plan to take. Today is the first step in a multi-step process and releasing these regulations and getting public comment and input on these regulations. So today is more of an overview, as I mentioned, the framework of the regulation. We'll be posting the draft regulation language on our website very shortly. Once we post the regulations on our website, it'll initiate a public comment period that will run through the end of our three required public meetings that we will be holding later in August. We plan to come back before the commission in August to discuss and go into detail on the regulation language, and we'll have the benefit of having some comments that have come in between now and August. So we'll be able to discuss those comments as they relate to the pertinent sections in the regulation. Then we'll hold the three public meetings throughout the state to again consider additional public comments on these regulations. And then we'll be back before the commission in September to synthesize those public comments and describe how we have refined the regulations to address those comments if needed. And finally, our plan is to adopt these regulations, draft emergency regulations, in the October timeframe. So we'll bring them before the commission for that adoption. Once adopted, we will submit the regulations to the Office of Administrative Law, and then we plan to open up the revision request window starting January 1st, 2016. So this is how we march through the informal comment process, the formal rulemaking, and then when the boundary regulations become operational. Because of the tight time frame we are working with the implementation of SGMA, the first window, and we've discussed this at previous meetings, will be a 90-day window for us to receive revision requests. And however, with getting the information out starting in July and these subsequent meetings, we feel that local agencies will have the opportunity to understand what's in the regulations and begin to work on collecting that information that is needed to justify a change. So how to provide input on these regulations as we move through the process, and we welcome public comment on these. And so that public comment can come in through email or written forms. And public comment that we receive at these commission meetings that we'll be presenting at over the next few months. We'll be holding the three public meetings as required in the statute. In Sacramento, the end of August, Bakersfield in the beginning of September, and then Orange County in the beginning of September. And we will be posting all public comments on our website, making it very easy and transparent to see what public comments come in. And the link there is where they'll be posted. So now I'd like to dive into the details of an overview of the draft regulations and to put them in context and go over the main concepts of the regulation. And it all starts with the existing basins. And those basins are defined in Bulletin 118, and they've always been defined using the best available information through time. And historically, modifications or revisions to basin boundaries have occurred at each update of Bulletin 118 through an existing water code authority that the department has. And so those modifications have created the 515 basins that we see here in the figure. And those are the existing basins local agencies can start with and either wanting to revise those boundaries of those basins or move on with SGMA development or implementation in those existing basins. So the requirements of this new process for local agencies to initiate or request the department make a change to boundaries. We're required to adopt these regulations by January 1st, 2016. There's a list of instructions to local agencies on what needs to be submitted. And local agencies is highlighted there because, as it says in the statute, only local agencies can request the department make a change. So the four key components of information needed to justify a change are information demonstrating the proposed basin can be sustainably managed, technical information on the conditions and the boundaries of the proposed basin, and then consultation with interested local agencies and public water systems in the affected basins, and then any other information DWR deems necessary. So the regulations really put specificity to these four key components, and the regulations also set up the methodology and criteria of how the department will assess that information for three critical criteria, and those are the likelihood that the proposed basin can be sustainably managed, whether the proposed basin would limit the sustainable management of adjacent basins, and whether there is a history of sustainable management of groundwater levels in the proposed basin. So key points on the regulations and our intent, and really the overall intent of these regulations is for statewide sustainable groundwater management, and that comes from the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and the intent of that, as well as the California Water Action Plan. We also plan to have this a very open and transparent process, and that has historically that has been the case when the department has made those changes. It's been an open process, and there's been public notification for these changes, and we plan to continue that tradition. So the technical components of what we're starting with and the existing basins we're working with really reflects, the existing basins reflect the complex hydrogeology that is statewide. The basin boundaries were last updated in 2003, so it's been quite a bit of time since these boundaries have been updated. And the previous boundaries were used for voluntary planning. And so that's a key point where there has been a lot of very successful groundwater management in these basins. However, it was voluntary. Now there's been a paradigm shift in the high and medium basins where it's required sustainable groundwater management planning that has to occur. So now these boundaries mean a lot more. So what that has done, it's left us with a varying level of detail on the existing Bulletin 118 data set. And through all of those points, that results in a high variability of the types of changes or revisions that we can expect to come in to the department. So these regulations are constructed in a way to this process to capture that variability. So administrative points, only local agencies, as I mentioned, can request the modification, and that local agency requests are voluntary. So this is not a mandatory requirement that basin boundaries need to change. It's a voluntary process. Whereas the groundwater sustainability plans, that's a mandatory, that's a requirement in the high and medium basins, whereas these regulations apply to all 515 basins, so high and medium and low and very low, but it's a voluntary process. So key definitions. The key definition here is the groundwater basin. So this is the whole alluvial aquifer system or stacked series of alluvial aquifers, the sort of the three-dimensional aquifer system, the lateral boundaries, the definable bottom, and the boundaries of that, the external boundaries of the aquifer have always been defined using scientific information, and we plan to carry that through these regulations. However, groundwater subbasins historically have been defined by dividing the larger groundwater basin into smaller units using geologic, hydrologic, or institutional boundaries. So we plan to carry that balance of scientific and jurisdictional information through these regulations with the internal boundaries, the subbasin boundaries. So now I'll walk through a graphic that shows the progression and the key elements of these regulations. So as I mentioned, all basin boundary modification requests start with the existing basins, and there's a decision point. And if no revision request is requested, the GSAs and GSPs can be formed and developed in the existing basins as they're described currently, and those existing basins will carry through to the next Bulletin 118, which is the interim update in 2017. A key point here is there's a lot of flexibility in the way that SGMA was constructed for GSA boundaries to take whatever shape that local agencies feel is necessary to comply with the Act. So there is that flexibility that GSA boundaries can form in whatever way and potentially not have to change the basin boundaries unless there's a need. So if there is a need to change a basin boundary, there are two major types of changes or revisions, scientific and jurisdictional. And I'll get into the details of each one of those. And for a particular basin, there can be multiple types of these changes for a basin. So the external boundary can be modified, and then on the other side of the basin, there can be other types of changes. So we're asking that all those types of changes are consolidated into one request per basin. So the types of modifications, scientific, those are the ones that are based on geologic or hydrologic conditions that define the basin. Jurisdictional modifications promote the adoption and implementation of effective sustainable groundwater management plans and that enhance local management of groundwater. So here are some figures, some examples of the different types of changes. So for scientific, this graphic shows a modification to the external boundary based on new geologic mapping or technical study. And also if there's identification of a new fault or barrier to flow, groundwater flow, that's another example where a new sub-basin line could be brought in or created. For jurisdictional types of modifications, the first type is internal changes. So those are the changes to boundaries between adjacent basins. So the example here is where the current line is on a river or stream, and it's snapped to a county line. And there's other examples, but that's just one. So the next type of modification is consolidation. This is where you're removing or eliminating internal lines. You're combining adjacent basins to enlarge the management area that these GSAs or GSPs will be managing. And there's a special case for this of county basin consolidation, where if a county wants to consolidate all of the contiguous basins in their county, there's an option for that. It's not required. These are all just options for local agencies to work with to help implement SGMA. And then the last type is subdivision. This is where existing basins or subbasins would be fragmented into smaller areas. So now there's three main components of the information needed to justify each one of these changes. So, and the blue arrow represents stakeholder input opportunities into this process. As I mentioned, we want this to be an open and transparent process. We don't want it to be a surprise that someone is requesting a local or a basin boundary request. We want it to be widely notified. So for every type of change requires that we have information on the local agency, that they're an eligible local agency, and that they hold a board or they have a board resolution initiating the basin boundary request. So what that does is it puts a minimum standard on at least one public meeting for every single basin boundary revision. So that's a key point. The next step is notification and consultation of these boundary revisions. And I'll go into detail here. So the department plans a series of activities to notify these changes. And first, we are planning an email notification system where people can sign up. Anyone can sign up and get an email notification of when a revision is requested in their basin or their part of the state or statewide. We will be posting the requests on our website, and we have tools that will make it very easy to understand where these requests are coming in. So a table of information and then an interactive map that will display these revision requests statewide. Then for the requesting local agency, as I mentioned, there's a requirement for board resolution initiating the change. Notification and consultation, we're requiring evidence of the methods used to identify interested local agencies and public water systems. We're requiring information on how the requesting agency corresponded with those interested parties. Also, another requirement is for a summary of public meetings that were held for these revision requests and the agendas, minutes, meeting summaries, as well as any public comment that came in as part of those public meetings. We want to see that type of information. The next component is local support that required for each type of boundary change. And this is a tiered system with increasing level of local support with the severity of the requested revision. And all along we've been messaging that for boundary revision in the state, there needs to be broad local agreement for these revisions, because these revisions have impacts on the implementation of groundwater management, also sustainable groundwater management in the high and medium basins. So that's been a key theme throughout all of our stakeholder engagement and outreach. So some more detail on the local support. So for the scientific revisions, the requesting agency, if they bring a valid scientific report or piece of evidence to us, and we review it and agree that that is a scientific revision that needs to be made that will result in the likelihood of sustainable management, the department needs to be able to make that change. And there might be some cases where local agencies might not agree to it, but if it's based on scientific reason, there we need to be able to make that change. And there are provisions I'll talk about that there's a check to that. However, for jurisdictional revisions, for internal changes, it's the affected affected agencies and public water systems. So for this case, in this figure, Agency A there is within the changed area. So this case, Agency A and both counties would have to support this revision. And so the way it's set up is that it's a sliding scale of local support. So if it's a minor internal boundary change, fewer local agencies that are affected and would have to support it. Whereas if it's a major internal boundary change, there'd have to be more local support and coordination on the ground to make sure that that effect is agreed upon, or that change is agreed upon at the local level. Consolidation, it's a majority of affected local agencies and public water systems. So there's a requirement that all of the interested local agencies and public water systems will need to be notified, but a majority of them have to support this change. And we've been messaging throughout this project that the potential of increasing management size, which would correlate to larger groundwater sustainability agencies and larger groundwater sustainability plans is a potential advantage. And so you're covering a larger part of the aquifer and managing that in a coordinated fashion. And so we feel that's a potential advantage. And so that's why it's one of the options here. And then finally, subdivision. This is where fragmentation of existing basins is occurring, and that the requirement, the draft requirement here, is that all local agencies and public water systems would have to agree or provide local support in the existing basin. And this is a high bar, and we've been messaging that fragmentation of basins is a potential disadvantage, and that it could actually lead to less coordination moving forward with the implementation of SGMA. And so if we start early on in the implementation of SGMA with fragmenting basins into small little pieces, it might provide a lot, or might produce a lot of additional coordination that would have to take place, and the water budgets, coordinating different water budgets between all those small basins. So that's sort of the rationale we've been working under. So for all of these revision types, there it's a requirement that there's notification and at least one public meeting, as I mentioned, but there will be multiple public meetings. And then there's a protest provision. So any person can protest a revision request. However, the information required in that protest needs to be at the same level, technical level, of the type of change they're protesting. So we will be posting all of the protests on our website. However, the department will be considering the protests in our evaluation, but we'll be evaluating those protests on the same criteria that comes in that is supporting the revision request. So the third and final component is technical information. And so for every type of change, the department needs a description of the basin boundaries. That's the maps, the GIS files, all the pertinent information that we need to redefine the boundaries if they're approved. For all jurisdictional revisions, we need to see evidence of existing water management in the basin. So an understanding that there's been management occurring, that can come in from existing groundwater management plans, adjudications, technical studies, basin plans, all of that information could fulfill that requirement. For scientific and consolidation and subdivision, we're requiring a good understanding of the hydrogeologic conceptual model. So if you're planning to make a big change to a basin, we feel that it's required that you have an understanding, a good understanding of that basin that you're trying to change. And so again, this is not a requirement for a full groundwater flow model. This is a requirement for the key components, the key aquifer systems, that a lot of this information is already in existing groundwater management plans, the existing Bulletin 118 basin descriptions, and other technical studies. So a lot of this information should be readily available for local agencies to use. And then finally, for subdivision, there's a requirement for historical and current conditions in the basin. And we feel that the local agency needs to demonstrate that they have a clear understanding of the conditions in the basins that they're potentially trying to subdivide, and that the and how that would affect the proposed basin, but also the remaining parts of the basin that are left. And the department needs that information to assess whether the fragmented basin or the portions of that basin, if that subdivision would result in the isolation the isolation of problem areas, groundwater problem areas, such as overdraft or land subsidence. So we want to make sure that the basin subdivision is not being used to fragment off groundwater problem areas. So for at any point, if a local agency does not have the information to justify the type of change that they're requesting, there's always a fallback position that GSAs and GSPs can be formed in the existing basins that currently are out there. So that's always an option. So as I talked about the protest provision, so there's a 30-day window for protest. As soon as the local agency submits the packet of information to the department, there's a 30-day window for those protests to come in. The department will then evaluate all of the information that we get. So we'll be looking at the public comments that come in, any protests, and then all of the technical information. And we'll be evaluating that information on those three key criteria that I mentioned earlier that are spelled out in statute. And we'll be coming up, or we'll be evaluating that and approving a draft list of basin boundary revisions that the department plans to support or initiate or work on. But we will post those on our website so it's publicly available, and we'll hold at least one public meeting to solicit comments on those that draft approved list. We'll then, now there's a requirement in the statute that we have to bring all of those draft approved boundaries to the commission for hearing and comment, and the commission has 60 days to hear and comment those. And our plan there is, for each revision request, we'll have a briefing sheet that has the rationale, why the technical information, why the department approved those revisions. We'll have all of the public comments that came in at the local level, the DWR level, and any protests that came in. So the commission, you'll have a clear understanding of the technical merits of that revision, as well as any public conversation and or protests that came in as part of that. Anticipated date for that action is the July-August 2016 timeframe to bring that information to the commission. So through all of that, through that process, we'll have a list of the final approved basin boundary revisions. And those, by statute, have to be memorialized in Bulletin 118 for them to be official. And so that's where they will go into Bulletin 118 2017. Our anticipated date for that is first quarter 2017. So that is pretty far away for local agencies to put all the information in January 1st, and then not know and certain that their boundary change is final until first quarter 2017. But as I mentioned, there will be some intermediate steps where the department will come out with a draft approved boundaries, so the local agencies will have a good understanding if they've made that list, and then if it makes it through the commission hearing and comment. So in the summer 2016 timeframe, there should be good evidence that of the type of the boundary revisions that we plan to make. So the next steps in this process, as I mentioned, we wanted to get the commission's input on this overall framework. And then we'll be posting the draft regulations on our website very shortly. And I'll be working with Executive Officer Landis and commission staff to make sure that the commission, all the commissioners are aware when we will be posting that and when it's available publicly. That will initiate a public comment period that will run from July all the way through September. So that's a long public comment period where we welcome public comments on these regulations. Then in August, we'll be coming back before the commission to review the draft regulation language and get into the details on the specific sections and the language of the regulation. And we'll have the benefit of some of those public comments that have already come in. We'll be holding our three public meetings throughout the state to also consider public comments, and we'll be running through a version of this presentation, and as well, and then everyone will have the draft regulation language. September will be before the commission again to synthesize all of the public comments that came in and give you an understanding of how we've refined the regulations based on that public input if needed. And then finally, October is when we're targeting to bring these draft regulations, or the final draft regulations, up for adoption. And then once that occurs, we'll be submitting the regulations to the Office of Administrative Law, which will then in January open up this first opportunity for local agencies to request changes. And as I mentioned, the July-August timeframe is when we are anticipating having those draft approved boundaries before the commission for hearing and comment. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone. And try to answer any questions you may have. And then these email links are just useful resources for local agencies related to the basin boundary modifications and the regulations. And if any questions or comments that aren't answered today or addressed today, please email those to the link on the email on the very bottom of the screen. So with that, thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Stephen. Excellent presentation, very clear and easy to follow. Commissioner Orth.
Yes, I was going to echo the complexity of this and the way you broke it down into, a well-organized and easy-to-understand PowerPoint or presentation gives me some encouragement and expectation, I guess, that the regs themselves will follow that simplicity. So, again, great job. I think very good. I had a couple of questions, and maybe I'll start with, I kind of got lost in the timing here, and I'm trying to think in my mind as the GSAs have their obligation to notice DWR by July of 2017 of their formation. We also have this boundary issue brewing for a lot of them. And I think you said spring or July of 20, what did you say? You said spring of 2017 before these would be in place. I missed something.
Yeah, so that's the final version is when it would be in Bulletin 118 published, and by statute, that's when they're official boundaries. However, the spring of 2016 is when the draft list of approved boundary revisions will be first notified. So those local agencies that are planning their GSA formation and SGMA activities on those basin boundary changes, they'll know spring 2016, or have some assurances that at least they've made that first cut.
And then the commission will take action under the current schedule in summer of 2016, so about a year in advance. Something to think about maybe as the regulations for the GSPs, the plan themselves are assembled, is some recognition of flexibility, perhaps. And again, I appreciate the necessity to create these windows and open enrollment periods, but we don't want to see a GSA or a GSP denied because we have a pending boundary issue brewing. So the nexus between the two should be considered. I will say, relative to the fragmentation discussion, and I appreciate the need to keep that option open, and I appreciate, frankly, the high bar that all local agencies need to be wrapped around that, and I think that's appropriate. Frankly, if we look back at the policy papers and the foundation of the Act itself, they recognized we were going to give local agencies the opportunity to create these new sustainability plans. But the recognition by policy papers and legislation was that groundwater should be managed at a basin level. And I think we want to try to avoid allowing a whole lot of backsliding to the current framework or structure of groundwater management through a fracturing, or fragmentation, I think was the word. So I think you've found a good balance there. I'll be interested to see what the public thinks about that. And I think the last question I want to ask, I'm going to put you on the spot. You said very shortly we're going to see the draft. Is that – when do you expect very shortly to be?
We plan to post the draft regulations by the end of this week.
Okay.
We wanted to make sure that there weren't
– Yeah, short enough. That's good.
That's our goal.
You needed feedback from us before you did that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much, Steve. We'll see you at the next. Look forward to the posting of the regulations and see you at the next meeting. Okay, next item. We are a bit time challenged, so hopefully we can, I think item 12, Jenny, will probably be after lunch is my guess, but hopefully it's next too. Number 10, which is the Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, Wildlife on Ecosystem Priorities, Scott Cantrell. Welcome back, Scott. supposed to go 12:30 to 1:30.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll get. You hear me? How's that? Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Scott Cantrell. I'm the Chief of the Water Branch in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And today I'm going to be discussing the draft ecosystem priorities that we've developed along with their relative environmental values and also the current status and next steps, so where we're going from here. I want to remind the Commissioners that the last time I was here speaking before you was in February of this year, and at that time what I told you was that we were just beginning to restart our effort and looking at the priorities that we drafted that were included in the draft regulation in 2012, and that since then, over the last 5 months, we've been working very closely with Commission staff and DWR, Water Board, Delta Stewardship Council. They're all part of our interagency team that meets at least once every couple of weeks talking about priorities and the solicitation and providing input on the issue papers and a whole variety of other topics. So we've been coordinating very closely with all those agencies. Fish and Wildlife has also been reaching out to NOAA Fisheries and the Fish and Wildlife Service because we think they're important partners for us to make sure that we have vet our priorities with them and get their input. And NOAA Fisheries did send a comment letter to the commission to Rachel with recommendations for their priorities back in, I think it was April. So we based our priorities largely on the priorities that were identified in the NOAA Fisheries Recovery Plan. We've also received many verbal comments at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meetings and some written comments on our priorities. And I think we're on a good path forward, and we're considering all the input that we've received over the last 5 months. And so so as you're well aware, the Prop 1 appropriates $2.7 billion to the Commission for public benefits. And the bolded language in this slide says, for ecosystem benefits that provide a net improvement in ecosystem and water quality conditions. And the department, as well as the State Water Board, have specific rules. We are, the Water Commission is to consult with us and receive input on our priorities and relative environmental values of ecosystem benefits. And the Water Board, who will be speaking after me, will talk about their water quality priorities and the relative environmental values of those benefits. And so what I'm going to present today is essentially the same presentation that I gave at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee on June 3rd. And over the last 6 weeks since June, we've been continuing our outreach with NOAA Fisheries and the Fish and Wildlife Service. We met with them just yesterday, and I'm very happy to report that they are expressing strong support for what we've drafted. They think it's very good. But we are updating these priorities, and the content is essentially the same, but the text that you're going to see is going to be condensed. We're reducing some of the redundancy that we feel is there and also trying to get the tense consistent. So I would expect by the next time I'm up here, we'll have an updated presentation, probably ready for the next commission meeting and stakeholder advisory committee meeting next month, I believe it is. So I just didn't have something quite ready to present today because we're in the process of making some changes as I speak. As I said, we just met with NIPS and service yesterday, got some good input. So here's the way we organized our priorities currently. There's six topic areas dealing with. The first one is recovering endangered, threatened, and other at-risk native species through project operations. The second one is to restore physical processes and flow regimes to improve habitats and natural communities to promote recovery. Third one is enhancing commercial and recreational opportunities. Fourth is reducing the negative impacts of non-native invasives on our native species and natural communities. Fifth one is reducing the negative impacts from in-river structures on anadromous fishes. And then finally, it's to increase the quality and quantity of aquatic and riparian habitat and managed and unmanaged wetlands for wildlife values. So those are the six topics that we address. In each of those, there's a number of specific priorities, and I think we've listened well to the input that we've gotten since earlier this year, where we were advised to try to make the priorities a little more specific, and so we've done that, and you'll see that in the next few slides. So the first one is pertaining to the recovery of listed species and other at-risk native species and native fish assemblages. So the first priority is addressing the need for cold water pool at the appropriate time and location in rivers to reduce water temperatures for egg and fry rearing of salmonids. Second one is to maintain dissolved oxygen concentrations in reds and to prevent the dewatering of reds in tributaries for that support salmon and steelhead. The third one is to provide flows to reduce juvenile stranding of salmon and steelhead. Then continuing on, this next one is also intended to highlight and prioritize the importance of avoiding stranding of immigrating adult salmonids that are impeded from their upstream migration in floodways and bypasses. Letter E, the next one, is to provide increased spring flows to improve conditions for juvenile and smolt outmigration. And then the next one is to provide summer flows to improve conditions for in-river rearing. And the next one is to provide attraction flows at the appropriate time and location to improve passage and to reduce straying of adults into non-natal streams. This is a long one, first one, so there's just a few more. Increasing delta outflow at the appropriate season for pelagic fishes, including delta smelt and longfin smelt, and restoring the seasonal patterns of flow and temperature to benefit the life stage specific requirements of green sturgeon and white sturgeon, including increasing outflow to promote juvenile recruitment. And then the next one is, it's a priority to operate these water projects with the existing state water system to promote integration and coordination and use operational flexibility and water exchanges to achieve the priorities that are described in this section. So that was the first goal. The first topic area. Now, the second one is focused on ecological form and function that is achieved largely through flow regimes. So it says it's our priority to restore those physical processes and flow regimes to improve native habitats and natural communities to promote the recovery of our target species. So the first priority, 2A, is to provide pulse flows to activate fluvial geomorphological processes, including accretion, erosion, maintaining channel form and function, and providing sediment transport. The next one, 2B, is to enhance habitat complexity and quality, including riffle pool complexes and providing in-channel complexity, like for escape cover for young fishes. And then 2C is to restore salmonid habitat in channels or sloughs, including rewatering of channels. Next one is pertaining to floodplain inundation, and it's to increase the frequency, magnitude, and duration of floodplain inundation to achieve multi-benefits of the providing wetlands habitat, increasing primary productivity, and food web support, provide for juvenile fish rearing, and also alternative migration corridors for immigrating fish. The next one, 2E, is to provide groundwater recharge and improve sediment quality and environmental water quality. And then 2F is to restore access of fishes to habitats to improve fish passage. 2G is to develop and implement sediment management plans, and this would include ensuring that there's adequate supply of gravels in stream for reds. 2H is restoring riparian communities to provide shade and adequate water temperature for aquatic species, and also recognizing that these riparian communities also are very important for terrestrial species like neotropical migratory birds and hawks and things like that. And then 2I is to enhance habitat by removing and modifying infrastructure that is impeding the movement of fish and wildlife species. So number three is to enhance commercial and recreational opportunities through achieving one or more of the following. And so this was something that we received some comments on at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. The comment was basically that it was felt that we were going beyond what was specifically required of the department in Prop 1, which says we're to provide ecosystem priorities and relative value. So it was felt that we shouldn't really be, stating, priorities for recreation and commercial value. Although, we did that with the intent of, part of our mission and our mission statement, which includes use and enjoyment by the public of natural resources. The department's mission statement is to manage California's diverse fish and wildlife and plant resources and the habitats upon which they depend for their ecological values and for their use and enjoyment by the public. So that's why we articulated these priorities relative to recreational uses, both consumptive and non-consumptive uses, including fishing and hunting, boating, swimming, and nature observation and education. And then 3B is to increase populations of economically valuable commercial or recreational species. And then 3C is increasing wildlife habitat on refuges or provide increased water supply to refuges. So 4 pertains to reducing the impact of non-native invasive species on our target native species and habitats and natural communities. And the two priorities in this category include developing and implementing invasive species management plans And the second one is to develop and implement water operations plans that use methods like flushing flows and thermal controls to suppress non-native species and to promote good habitat for the native species and to promote the restoration of natural communities. So number five is reducing the impact on anadromous fishes by one or more of the following, and these are things like remediating unscreened or poorly screened diversions that entrain fish. 5B is remediating existing barriers to fish passage, and then 5C is to construct and operate facilities to reduce stranding and mortality in floodways and bypasses. And then finally, number six is to increase the quality and quantity of aquatic and riparian habitats and managed and unmanaged wetlands by achieving one or more of the following. And this includes providing water to enhance wetlands and riparian habitats for the benefit of aquatic and terrestrial species. And the second one, 6B, is to enhance managed seasonal wetlands on wildlife refuges and other lands being managed for public ecosystem values. So the next topic that I'll cover quickly, and then I'll take any questions you may have after I describe our next steps. The relative environmental values is something that we're also required to provide in addition to the ecosystem priorities. And these are things like, we have 11 of them that we've identified, and these are things like the number of ecosystem priorities that are addressed. So the more priorities a grant applicant includes in their proposal, the better, generally. Consistency with existing conservation and recovery plans is important. Water use efficiency, getting the most use out of a single block of water. Some have called it environmental water use efficiency. That would be of higher relative environmental value. Having number four, having measurable rather than just descriptive benefits. In other words, having very clear metrics and projected outcomes and performance measures. Those are all very important and would further increase the relative environmental value. Proximity to existing resources. What this means is areas, project operations, and fish and wildlife habitats that are protected if they're close to areas that are already under conservation, like, say, contiguous or adjacent to, say, a wildlife area, you know, creating larger blocks of protected habitat, of course, is better. And also the proximity of the ecosystem benefits to the project itself is, you know, the closer that nexus is, we feel it's easier to make a more compelling case that they're in describing those benefits.
Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to, it's 12:13, and I'm wondering, the state board folks have been so patient, and it looks like I think it might be after lunch, so I'm hoping that if that's okay. So I don't want you to feel obligated to stay. If you want to go before then, but if that's okay, that would be great, because I think there will be some questions and want to give you, of course, appropriate time to respond as well and communicate with us. So just wanted to give you that.
So you want to hold off the
No, I want to finish with you. I wanted to give the state board who's waiting on the next item that it's going to be after lunch, so I apologize.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm actually just about done.
Yeah, well, we probably have some Q&A here.
Yeah. Okay, so I was just talking about proximity to existing resources, and I talked about the metrics, having clear metrics such as flow, volume of cold water, improvements in water temperature, floodplain inundation, acres, and how all these are going to benefit our target species would be important. The expected magnitude of measurable benefits. Number seven is clear performance measures. Number eight is the certainty of achieving benefits. The immediacy of the benefits that are achieved, and the duration or permanence of those benefits. And then finally, the ability of these projects and project operations to have resilience and adaptability to projected climate changes. So those are the priorities and the relative environmental values. And so as I said earlier, I expect that if the commission so desires, I would be available to provide our updated priorities and values at the next meeting and at our stakeholder advisory committee meeting next month. So we're continuing to do outreach with our partners. We're going to be meeting again with NOAA Fisheries and the Fish and Wildlife Service in about 2 weeks to look at our updated draft. And we're still participating with our partners every 2 weeks at our interagency team meeting. We're providing input on topics I think you're going to hear about later today about the solicitation process and how we're going to be evaluating proposals and conducting technical review and scientific review and all those steps involved in a competitive solicitation program. So we're providing input on all that as well. And we're still on target to have what I think is going to be a very tight, concise set of priorities and relative environmental values by August. So I think we're in much better place than we were back in February when I was here talking before, where we were just beginning to start this work, and it seemed so abstract and overly complex, but I think we're getting very close now to having good language for the regs.
Great. Thank you very much, Guy. I agree that you guys, you've done a lot of work, so I appreciate it, and it's laid out very clearly as well. So I'll open it up for any questions or comments. All right, maybe we're moving faster now. Commissioner Orth.
Sorry. I have a question, and actually I have a question and a comment. The question is on the relative values. I guess I'm curious as to how you see balancing certainty with climate change adaptability and resilience. I mean, it seems like those are two ends of the spectrum.
Certainty, you know, what we have in mind there is if a project is, you know, purporting to provide a whole suite of benefits, it has to be supported by technical information, ideally quantitative information, model outputs, the standard sorts of information that we see that DWR and Reclamation puts out for their water operations, and also to the degree that models are available, I know there are some tools for quantifying benefits to species and to vegetation and so on. You know, the more quantitative, the better, just in general. So that's what we mean by certainty. By your reference to the how do we reconcile that with the uncertainty of, say, climate change? Was that your question?
Yeah, I mean, you have as one of your priorities, you know, being flexible and adaptable to climate, resilient and flexible, adaptable to climate change, which is the last. And I guess what I'm hearing you say is there's going to have to be some. And I certainly appreciate that we want certainty and quantified, you know, quantifiable information to understand the potential benefits or the reported benefits of a project, but they're also going to have to be cognizant of an uncertain future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the ability to kind of move into that uncertain future such that those benefits still have, you know, some value.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. The other comment I guess I would make, I'm not at all surprised that we heard from stakeholders objections to the commercial and recreational opportunities, and maybe you made this point and I just missed it, but in addition to ecosystem, you know, there is a entirely separate public benefit criteria or category for recreational purposes, and so I certainly think it's well within your purview to provide input to us on that as well as the ecosystem priorities. And maybe making that clarification gets you out of the trap that some people may set.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. I was going to echo that as well. And maybe when you come back, I'd be curious what some of the input is on that, because that strikes me as something that might be problematic or concerning to people about characterizing ecosystem benefits as what people might see as recreational, given the other category. But I understand the mission, and it's just a question of whether it fits into the definition of ecosystem benefit or not for your purposes. But
yeah, that's my quandary as well.
Okay, well,
we fully expect to have a role in that when we get to the discussion about recreation benefits and the. There's the requirement in the Prop 1 of project sponsors entering into contracts with the agencies that are administering the public benefits.
Sure.
So we envision we're going to have a role in, you know, throughout this process, including during implementation.
Yeah, I agree. Commissioner DelBosque.
I'm trying to see how I can reconcile these two things. Increased populations of economically valuable commercial or recreational species, and then develop and implement invasive species management plans.
Yeah.
I want to see how those two go together. Maybe I'm just a dumb farmer over here thinking about these invasive species, what we're supposed to do with them.
Well, so, yeah, we recognize that was problematic, so in the current version that we're working on, we have a modifier there which says native species, enhancing the populations of native species that have commercial and recreational value.
Okay. It says increased populations of economic. Okay.
Yeah, in the draft that we're working on,
going to suggest that language coming forward. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Gotcha.
And also maybe revisit whether it's appropriate to have there or under the recreation benefit. Got it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Scott.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Very good.
Okay. Well, we're at 12:23. Do we want to do the state board here quickly? I might have to slip out. 12:30, or would you? How long do you guys think the state board? We don't want to give you your appropriate amount of time. We could always come back.
We don't mind coming back after lunch.
15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Come back.
Okay. Yeah. If that's okay, that'd be great. On full bellies,
we'll be much better
listeners.
I'd like to interject too that the agenda says we'll be reconvening in room 340, but in fact we'll reconvene here.
Okay, great. All right, I'm going to reconvene the Water Commission meeting exactly at 1:30. Okay, we're going to hear first from the State Water Resources Control Board, and then for those in attendance, we'll have the follow-up on the model water efficiency landscape ordinance after that. Dorina, welcome. Thank you for your patience this morning. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here to introduce the State Water Board's draft water quality priorities. Scott did a really good introduction, so I won't certainly try not to duplicate some of the things that he said. But as you're aware, the State Water Board is charged with identifying priorities and relative environmental values of water quality benefits. So today I'm going to present to you the State Water Board's 8 draft water quality priorities associated with and potentially influenced by water storage projects. So please keep in mind that these priorities are not listed in order of priority, but rather reflect the State Water Board's high priority water quality issues that could be positively influenced by water storage projects. So the first 5 priorities here addressed impaired water bodies in California's Clean Water Act Section 303D list. So we have improved water temperature, dissolved oxygen, nutrient, mercury, and salinity conditions. And I will talk a little bit more in depth as we move forward. These 3 here, 6, 7, and 8, deal with groundwater flows and local water supply development. So the first one, our first priority is to improve water temperature conditions in water bodies on the 303D list that are impaired for temperature. So as you're aware, water temperature affects the toxicity of chemicals, physical habitat, life cycle, growth rate, and survival of aquatic life. So impounding water impacts temperature regimes within a reservoir and in water bodies downstream of a reservoir. Waters tend to be temperature stratified in a reservoir. They'll be warmer at the top and colder at the bottom, for example. And then there tends to be a shift from cold water species to warm water species. So the State Water Board supports projects that would provide measurable improvements in temperature levels to reduce or eliminate exceedances of temperature water quality objectives downstream of reservoirs. Currently, on the 303D list, there are no reservoirs listed for temperature, just water bodies downstream of reservoirs. And achieving this priority may involve designing and operating reservoirs in a way that physically and temporally results in achieving these objectives for temperature. The next one is dissolved oxygen. Just a little background, some of this information is not on the slides. All aquatic life, you know, depends on oxygen dissolved in the water for health and survival. And as with temperature, dissolved oxygen can become stratified in a reservoir as well. So waters can be warm at the surface, and they'll be dissolved oxygen rich. While at the bottom of the reservoir, it tends to be colder water, and it's dissolved oxygen depleted. So the State Water Board basically supports projects that would improve DO conditions in water bodies on the 303D list and provide measurable improvements to attaining water quality objectives for dissolved oxygen. Achieving this priority may involve, similar to what the temperature priority said, designing and operating reservoirs in a manner that releasing water physically and temporally results in achieving objectives for DO. And I just want to point out that many of the design and operation factors that address temperature will also address dissolved oxygen, nutrients, and mercury conditions, which I will touch on in just a moment. So you can experience multiple benefits across multiple priorities. So nutrients, improve nutrient conditions in water bodies on the 303D list as well. Nutrients are essential to supporting algae and aquatic plants, which hence provide food for and habitat for aquatic life. Waters at the top of the reservoirs can be nutrient depleted, and at the bottom they can be nutrient rich. And this is especially true for new reservoirs. When you submerge plant matter, it decays and becomes nutrient rich at the bottom of a reservoir. High nutrients in a water body can also cause algal blooms, which are sometimes toxic. That can impact recreation, harm water quality, have impacts on ecosystem health and aquatic life, as well as human health if the contaminated water or contaminated fish is consumed. So the State Water Board supports projects to provide measurable improvements in nutrient levels to obtain water quality objectives for nutrients in waters downstream of reservoirs and in reservoirs as well. Some of these actions include managing nutrient loading, managing sediment, managing recycled wastewater. I won't go through all of these. Aerating bottom waters, harvesting aquatic plants, and managing biological communities. Those are some of the potential strategies. Mercury, again, improvements in mercury conditions and water bodies on California's 303D list. Methylmercury, as you know, is a neurotoxin with health risks to humans and wildlife through the consumption of contaminated fish. Mercury can enter the water column through a variety of sources, mainly through erosion of rock and soil, which deposits natural mercury, atmospheric deposition. So a reservoir is a large surface area that can get a lot of mercury from the atmosphere, mining waste as well, and other discharges such as stormwater discharges. So it's estimated, based on speaking with staff from the State Water Board, that about half of California's reservoirs have been predicted to contain fish with methylmercury levels high enough to warrant a mercury control program. So the State Water Board supports projects that would provide measurable improvements to mercury or methylmercury levels in water or sediment to achieve water quality objectives for mercury in reservoirs and downstream of reservoirs. And we are listing out some of the potential strategies. For example, you can aerate the bottom sediment and waters. You can change the timing and location of your reservoir discharges. You can cap or dredge bottom sediment, limit the extent of flooded areas, and reducing the source or sources of mercury before flooding. Salinity as well. We support improvements in salinity conditions for water bodies listed on the 303D list. Elevated salinity in surface water and groundwater can damage crops, degrade drinking water, and damage industrial equipment. Salts in the delta are typically derived from tributary sources and the Pacific Ocean, so freshwater inflows will repel or balance seawater intrusion in the delta. However, there have been changes in hydraulic and hydrologic patterns and conditions in the delta, which has resulted in changes in salinity. So the State Water Board supports measurable improvements in salinity levels to eliminate water quality objective exceedances for salinity in the delta, the San Joaquin River, and any waters that are impaired for salinity downstream of reservoirs. We listed out some potential strategies that could be considered. Some of those operating or physical changes at the delta export pumps or to the delta channels, treating or reusing ag drainage, LID and green infrastructure technologies to capture and infiltrate stormwater runoff, and also establishing or enhancing local groundwater management efforts. So those were the priorities that dealt with water bodies that are on the 303D list. So now we move towards our other priorities. This one is protect and or clean up groundwater and DWR's CASGEM high and medium priority basins. So there are 515 total basins statewide. 43 of these have been designated as high priority and 84 have been designated as medium priority. These medium and high priority basins account for 96% of the state's annual groundwater pumping and supply 88% of the population overlying groundwater basins. So basically, groundwater is representing a large and growing portion of the state's water supply and is particularly vulnerable to contamination. Once groundwater has been contaminated, it is very difficult and costly to clean up, so prevention is key. In some areas of the state, contamination of groundwater has basically eliminated that groundwater source as suitable for drinking water in those areas. So we support using recycled water to improve or protect groundwater quality, large-scale groundwater cleanup efforts where you cannot identify a responsible party, using barrier wells to prevent or reduce seawater intrusion, and preventing contamination in groundwater from spreading, especially to groundwater that is used as a drinking water source. Our seventh priority is to achieve delta tributary stream flows that would resemble natural hydrographic patterns or other flow regimes that would improve conditions for aquatic life. Hydrology of the delta has been highly regulated by water diversion, storage, and use that has resulted in homogeneous flows in the delta. Lack of flow and habitat variability favors non-native species over native species. So the State Water Board supports projects that result in delta flows or delta tributary stream flows that resemble natural hydrograph patterns or that have demonstrated to improve conditions for native aquatic life. especially projects that would improve flow for the Delta ecosystem. Such projects may involve designing to divert and store high flows that would exceed flow criteria caps and are demonstrated to exceed flows needed for aquatic habitat. And our last priority is reduce current or future water demand on the Delta watershed by developing local water supplies. Improvement in stream flow conditions and water quality in the Delta can potentially be achieved by increasing or augmenting local water supplies south or north of the Delta. As an example, developing local water supplies south of the Delta could reduce reliance on imported Delta water while supporting a more reliable local water supply. So the State Water Board's highest priorities for increasing local water supplies, which may also have water quality benefits, include maximizing the use of recycled water, increasing stormwater capture and reuse, which is low-impact development and green infrastructure, and conjunctive use. That is it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions from any of the commissioners? Yeah, Commissioner Herrera.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the information. I just had a question in relationship to AB 685, the human right to water. I know that's a policy that this commission will have to consider as we're developing the storage investment program. And I was wondering if State Water Board has any recommendations for us on how to incorporate that given.
I do. I will have my colleague Nathan Weaver, legal counsel, come up and address that for you.
And then also one suggestion, you know, on the priority number six, you talk about the basins and high and medium, but maybe also looking at basins that have, you know, significant number of disadvantaged communities without safe drinking water could also be mentioned in the priorities.
Yes, definitely. We have, as we've been developing these draft priorities, you know, that certainly is a focus for the State Water Boards as well as providing clean, accessible drinking water, the human right to water. So there has been a large push towards focus on disadvantaged communities. So I will definitely take that back to the State Water Board and we'll see how we can address that and incorporate it.
Great. Thank you.
So I'm Nathan Weaver, staff counsel for the State Water Board and our legal advisor on this project. With respect to the how the human right to water relates to our water quality priorities, we are, and I don't have the statute in front of me, but we're in essence instructed to look at water quality improvements that provide significant public trust resources or that clean up and restore groundwater. We've looked pretty closely at the public trust language, and we don't think that the legislature intended to incorporate projects for providing water supply for domestic consumption into the public trust doctrine. That's a legal doctrine that mainly has dealt with in-stream uses historically, and although the courts could change it, it's a common law doctrine. We don't see that as a board being able to start that conversation. On the groundwater side, that, you know, clearly is concerned with making safe water available for domestic consumption. We're still reviewing how to best incorporate human rights to water concerns into our priorities there. So I really appreciate your suggestion. The other area that we've noted, and this is something that the Water Commission would be the decision maker on, not the State Board, but there may be ways to address the human right to water through the emergency supply provisions, which is another public benefit. I know that your staff and DWR staff have looked much more closely at that than I. So I wouldn't want to get out in front of anyone, but I think that is still being looked at as well.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Commissioner Orth. Actually, I would suggest relative to priority number eight, as it's written, reduce current or future water demand on the Delta. I guess I'd like to see a little bit more thought and reconciliation of that statement against the California Water Action Plan and
you know, really the co-equal goals objectives of dealing with Delta solutions. I think I get it, and I think one way that you could probably make this point a little clearer would be to incorporate some of the concept of integrated regional water management planning and the Act's objectives, that Act's objectives into this. Mm-hmm. But I think we want to be careful that this doesn't look as if the objective is to just, you know, terminate exports from the Delta.
Yes, I agree. So I will go ahead and take note of your comments. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we will probably be briefing you guys in September, I believe.
I have one more question. So on the relative environment, I think maybe you said it up front, so the relative environmental values, and is that, I mean, here's your priority list, right? Mm-hmm. And then how are you going to do, I'm anticipating something along the lines of what Fish and Wildlife presented, where it's going to, I mean, are you going to emphasize some over others, or how is that going to work?
At this point, the State Water Board doesn't disagree with the relative environmental value list that Fish and Wildlife just presented, so it looks as though we will follow suit with their list as well.
Got it. Okay, so the environmental, the water quality and values are going to be in sync with what Fish and Wildlife is presenting.
At this point, I believe that is the track we're taking. We can update you when we meet again in September and let you know if we've been directed by our board members or management to take a different direction.
Okay. I mean, whatever it is that you're ultimately recommending is fine. I'm just trying to get my head around it. So we've got the priorities, mm-hmm. and then the relative value of water quality benefits is likely going to be in sync then with what Fish and Wildlife has provided.
Mm-hmm.
So there wouldn't then be a, maybe I'm off base here, there wouldn't be a prioritization of, or there is a prioritization, there wouldn't be I get it. I'm thinking about the water quality separately from the environmental one. I should be thinking about them kind of as the same.
Yeah, you I'm sure that you guys noticed a lot of overlap, or you saw.
Yeah, which is good that you're coordinating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your
input. Okay. Now we're going to go back to the model Water Efficient Landscape Ordinance, which was item number 8 on the agenda. And I think that we've got, is Peter Rostrom here? Welcome back, Peter. We had taken a break prior to lunch to allow Peter an opportunity to digest some of the suggestions that were made during public comment. And now we'll hear from you. Thanks for coming back, Peter.
So we went back and looked at some of the suggestions and looked at Appendix D and sort of saw three key areas that were, you know, as sort of you described it, sort of low-hanging fruit that really should be a part of Appendix D. And I believe you have the errata sheet that we provided. One is to require that irrigation controllers utilize a rain sensor. And that's in 5A of the sheet, if everyone's with me. So, and then the other two, one is, we see this as being sort of a key provision of the main ordinance, that areas less than 10 feet in width in any direction should be irrigated with subsurface irrigation or other means that produces no runoff or spray. And so often in our urban landscapes, it's those small areas that are really hard to irrigate. And encouraging people to use subsurface drip or drip irrigation or technology that will eliminate oversprays really reduces water waste and even the perception of water waste. The final one is for non-residential projects, commercial, industrial, and institutional projects over 1,000 square feet. They should have a submeter to measure landscape water use. And finally, we're having problems with our definition section and just realized at lunch that the definition of parkway, which was in the June 12th draft, was not in the July 9th draft, and so we've included that errata sheet as well. Any questions on these changes? I should say we looked at some of the other comments we felt were, in regards to water features, that requirement will be captured already. The Appendix D requires that 75% of the landscape area be in low water use plants, so you could not put in a water feature that exceeded 25%, which was the correction that was suggested. And also the definitions, we consulted with council, and the definitions from the main ordinance apply to Appendix D as well. So, any questions?
No questions from us. Thank you very much, Peter. Opportunity for public comment, I'm assuming. Yeah, just come on up and introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Bob Raymer, Senior Engineer with the California Building Industry Association. Why we would have preferred that the Commission go forward with the original package. Our main goal today is to see this get adopted. If these three changes, which are quite modest, give you a comfort level for adoption today, we're fine with that. So we look forward to seeing this adopted so we can begin work on the building standards in the Title 24 process. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Tracy Quinn with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're pleased to see the changes that are made and included in your errata sheet. The one comment I would have, and it's something that Mr. Brosom spoke to, is that in Appendix D, Section 3, he stated that the statement that 75% of the plant area should be low water use plants. We feel that with the use of the word plant area as opposed to landscape area, that there could be some confusion about whether or not water features would be able to find this loophole and slip in. So I would just recommend that instead of the word plant, you replace that with the word landscape area, which is defined already within the model ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. Any member comments or Peter, you last chance to speak if you like.
Going to review the definition of landscape area, but we feel that plant area and landscape area are close enough that the change would not have to be made at this time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Ball.
What if you had a lily pond? It'd be planted water. Now, I'm sure that's what she's bringing up. I'm being facetious. I think that I agree with her, actually, on that. So.
Well, I will let me pull up the... So as the definitions... The landscape area means all planting areas, turf areas, and water features in the landscape designed to the maximum applied water allowance calculation. So, I mean, we could go back and make that change. That would take time for us to print it and post it. But I...
Understood.
So I'll let you guys...
Great. Okay, any more discussion by the commissioners? If not... At your pleasure here.
Peter, I just want to thank you for taking a look at this and making these changes, and I want to thank all the public comment today. I do remember when the previous version of this model water efficient landscape ordinance came out, and seeing this now today, there are some really significant changes that I think address the needs of our state right now in terms of water conservation and managing our landscapes better. So thank you to all of you for your work in making this a good ordinance, and I would move that we adopt it as amended today.
Great. So we're going to adopt it in the form with these errata sheet changes, which have been distributed to us. So I have a motion. Is there a second? Second by Commissioner Curtin. Ms. Landis, would you please call a roll?
Commissioner Ball.
Yes, I support.
Commissioner Byrne.
Yes.
Commissioner Curtin.
Aye.
Commissioner Daniels.
Yes.
Commissioner Del Bosque.
Yes.
Commissioner Herrera.
Yes.
Commissioner Orr.
Yes.
Commissioner Quintero.
Yes.
Motion passes. Okay, I want to thank everyone as well, and especially Peter for all the hard work in the short time frame you had and for spending the extra time here over lunch. We appreciate it. And thank you to the public for your comments and participation.
That's the formal resolution. I don't know if we need to at least put it in the minutes.
Okay, I'll announce it as resolution number 2015-02, which is resolution to adopt the Model Water Efficient Landscape Ordinance Regulation. Okay, great. Okay, at this time, we're actually going to recess, and we're going to move to room 340. And I'm sorry for the inconvenience. We ran a little late this morning, but we're going to have the workshop portion of our meeting. We'll be getting into the water storage investment program details. So we will reconvene in about no later than 10 minutes in room 340.